formal informational meeting on the House Interim Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. And to kick off the beginning part with regard to Sustainable Agricultural Resource Center, OSARC, we're going to have Representative Clem give a little brief overview, and then we'll invite some people up to talk a little bit more. So,
great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to refresh our memories, the Sustainable Agriculture Resource Center is something that came out of a Oregon Solutions process initially, and the theory behind the center is that growers are meeting a changing marketplace, and often without necessarily the on-the-ground expertise in all the different nuances of certifications, and that it would be helpful if I turned off my cell phone so that buzzing stopped. Oh, sorry.
Here you go, Beth. In the meantime, will they deviate from policy?
So the theory behind it is to give resources to growers who are facing problems out there dealing with all manners of aspects of certification, because you've got use of pesticides and how to maybe use integrated pest management processes to reduce that a little bit. You've got housing conditions for your workers. You've got mitigation for environmental benefits. You've got a lot of different things that will sometimes go into a certification, and a lot of time the growers will have questions, and it would be great to have someone to pick up the phone and call, because we have markets, especially in Europe, where you don't get in if you're not certified to meet their standards, and so it's hurting some of our profitability to not be able to get certified. So we had a work group after we last talked where we heard a little bit about the proposal in general, just to sort of hash out exactly how the program would work initially. Scaled back the proposal a little bit from a budgetary side. We felt like getting the certification folks up and running, having a database of all the different information, so they could be helpful when someone does pick up the phone and call them and they don't have to refer you 20 times, is important. But a kind of public purpose website, which is what we'd initially had in there, would be something that we could do later, where the goal is to get the person on the phone knowledgeable for the grower to call, and not necessarily yet advance to the stage where you have a massive web plus presence, where the farmers are going to be getting everything they need and never even have to talk to a human being. And from my experience, that would be not uncommon for a farmer to want to pick up the phone and call someone, even if there is a website. So we kind of are delaying the implementation to see if that's needed and do some surveying and see if there really isn't a really big public presence needed with all the same information the human being could give you. So that's scaled back a little bit and brings the dollar figure down a little bit. And then I think you've got a large group of people here from somewhat diverse interests who, by the end of that, once we sort of worked on the budget side of it, are all able to come and support the proposal. That's what I'm expecting to hear, hopefully.
And so we will invite the work group kind of to come up, however many of them want. So we've got Scott Exo, Tracy Medinma, Rick Jacobson, Katie Fest, Allison Hensley, whoever wants to come on up, and Brian Witz. I guess they haven't figured out, so that's good.
Chair Roble, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Scott Exo. I'm the executive director of an organization called Food Alliance, which I'll inform you a little bit more about as we go along. Representative Clem provided a very good introduction to the concept that the Oregon Sustainable Ag Resource Center is intended, and the function it's intended to fulfill. My task is to speak to you as an organization that represents a certifier, a certification program, and I'm going to try to enlarge the picture to help you understand the growth and the importance of certification for a variety of reasons. And I have with me to my left Tracy Medinma, who represents both a grower and a processor interest, and she's here to talk about how certification plays a role in the business she represents at Stellenbosch Island Farms, and the conundrum we find ourselves in as certification grows in importance, but the growers try to meet those expectations, and thus the need for an institution like OSARC. Food Alliance is a nonprofit organization that's celebrating its 10th anniversary this coming year. And the organization was created here in the Northwest to to leverage market incentives for good agricultural practices. That's the simplest way to put it. It was created by a handful of people at the two land-grant universities in the Northwest, WSU and OSU, representatives from the food industry, from advocacy groups for issues affecting both the environment and farm labor, and consumer activists. And what they did was create a certification program that was very broad in scope that covered things like many of the issues that Representative Clem mentioned, soil and water conservation, the protection and enhancement of wildlife habitat, the reduction of pesticide use, safe and fair working conditions, and in animal systems, humane treatment for animals. So we've staked out a territory for certification that is very broad in scope because we think agriculture has a large footprint, and when done well, it has an opportunity to create environmental and social values and add value to the both the physical and human systems that it influences. So what's been our experience at Food Alliance in that 10 years? We started out certifying farms in 1998. Stalbush Island Farms was among the first. The first products we actively helped promote and bring to consumers' awareness around this certification were apples in a couple of stores in the Portland market. And today, there are over 270 Food Alliance certified farms and ranches in 19 states. That's how quickly things have sort of accelerated. The geographic footprint for that certification, the certification of those farms and ranches is about 5 million acres. About 129 of those producers are in Oregon, and they manage 2.4 million acres, a lot of which is rangeland. Many of you have heard of Oregon Country Beef. We've been the certifier of record for them for going on 7 years. The farms and ranches we certify raise beef, lamb, pork, dairy products, mushrooms, wheat, and other grains, legumes, and a wide variety of fruits and vegetables. Just about everything you can find in a grocery store. In 2006, the estimated sales of Food Alliance certified products was about $85 million. And the numbers of certified entities have been growing at a rate of about 25% a year since 2002. The vast majority, over 98% of those farms and ranches, are family-owned businesses. Since 2006, Food Alliance has begun to certify food handlers as well, and by that we mean distributors as well as processors and manufacturers, people like Norpak, Druid Brothers, who's an example of whose product you have in front of you. They offer a variety of canned and frozen fruits and vegetables, dried beans and lentils, cheeses, canola oil, and other products. Pendleton Grain Growers is one of our customers. They're starting a crushed oilseed business for edible canola oil. So they're using this as a way to diversify their work as well. So what does certification do? Why do farmers and ranchers seek out certification? Well, one of the things certification does is it offers an opportunity to differentiate their products based on social and environmental performance. As we see a growing focus on what many call sustainability, that offers both a challenge for agricultural producers, but it offers a business opportunity as well to distinguish themselves from their competitors. And when employed successfully, they gain market advantages for that performance. It's also an opportunity to transition from commodity markets, which are in which producers compete largely on price. And we know how that's played out for growers of late. They're competing in markets among increasingly global markets where the playing field is tilted. They're competing against markets where labor is cheaper, where environmental regulations are often less stringent, and commodity markets for many producers are often a losing proposition in that increasingly globalized market. So differentiating one's products on the basis of these new considerations is an opportunity to add value to their products and command a higher price and gain access to new markets in many cases. It's also a way to assure their customers that they're meeting what we see as rising expectations for that same kind of a social environmental performance, to offer transparency to the people to whom they sell their products, if you will. Why is it growing in importance? Why is certification becoming important? Well, there are the positives where people are looking for transparency in practices, but there are also some of the negatives. We've had highly publicized events in our nation's food system around mad cow disease in livestock systems. We've had E. coli outbreaks in green onions and more recently in spinach. And there are many controversies around so-called factory farms, the conditions in which animals are raised, the conditions in which chickens are grown, and things like that. And as a result, people are asking more of their food supply and of their food system, and they're asking tougher questions. The other reason is a simple business matter. Buyers, large buyers of products and institutional buyers, wholesale buyers for retail chains are using specifications around, we're using certification as a specification for the things they buy increasingly. So growers are increasingly asked, are you certified by X or Y or EuropeGAP or organic or something else, as an entry question to gain access to those markets. So what's happening outside of our experience in the certification world? Other agricultural certification programs are growing as well. I talked to certified organic certifiers accredited by the USDA very frequently, and most of them have a 6 to 8 to 9 week waiting period just to get an inspector out on the ground because the demand for certification is so great. So it's not just in our world that we're seeing growth, it's in other certifications as well. The sales of organic certified products is growing at a rate of 20% a year in a food marketplace that grows at about 1 or 2%. So that gives you a sense of where things are headed there. So why OSARC? Why is OSARC important in this whole equation of growing demand and importance for certification? There's really two very simple reasons. One, because demand exceed supply. As you'll hear Tracy and others say in just a moment, they can't get their hands on enough certified product. So there's a lag in the adoption of certification and adoption in the practices that qualify growers to take advantage of these new market opportunities, and we find ourselves in a situation where they need help, as I think Representative Clem explained quite well. The growers need help when they're pursuing certification, and even when they're not, there are growing expectations around regulation, around transparency of practices, regardless of whether growers think they need certification, and often they need help changing their practices or access to technical and financial resources in the form of government incentives for fencing a stream or for investing in water conservation measures. So OSARC is not just envisioned as an opportunity for learning about certification, but an opportunity for all growers statewide to make improvements in their practices if they can access the proper information. And as Representative Clem indicated, sometimes accessing that information is the hardest part. It's not built into a farmer's timeline or day to be able to surf the internet for 3 hours to find information about how to comply with labor regulations or to improve wildlife habitat on his or her property. We're hoping that by bringing the OSARC concept to bear, we can shorten that information timeline so they can have access to those resources, begin making those changes rather expeditiously. What's unique about OSARC? I've been participating in this concept for 2.5 years. And if you look at the list of signatories to the governor's original Oregon Solutions agreement, you'll find a rather unlikely cast of characters. And I urge you to think about the last time you saw such a divergence of interests as wide as the Defenders of Wildlife, Oregon Tilth, NORPAC, the Xerxes Society, and the Oregon Association of Cooperatives. That's a pretty unique coalition of folks that all agree on the need for resources to help farmers avail of this economic opportunity but also make changes for the better of the state. The commitment has lasted through 2 years of virtually no funding for this concept, and yet we're still meeting and building out the vision and the technical committees that will support this work. It's also unique in that it's both a rural and an urban concept. It helps tie the interests of all Oregonians together for a robust and thriving agriculture, as well as healthy ecosystems and quality of life for farm workers, all the concepts that are embedded in the kind of technical assistance that this envisions providing. And it's also grounded in some sound economic principles. It allows the market to drive positive change in agricultural practices because of the market incentive that's out there for those kinds of commitments. And it offers Oregon another way to distinguish itself on the basis of its commitment to sustainability. So with that, I'll conclude and introduce Tracy Nima.
Thank you, Scott. Good morning, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to have a few minutes to tell you about Stallbush. I work for a farm here in Oregon. We are 4,500 acres. Stallbush Island Farms. Bill and Carla Chambers are the family. They have four children, three of whom have already expressed an interest in continuing this family farm. And this is a farm that was really founded on principles of sustainability. And at its core, we are trying to create a better food system. Oregon is perceived across this country as a real hotbed and as a place of leadership in sustainability. The organizations Oregon Tilth and Food Alliance are extremely progressive in the areas of agriculture, and my role at Stallbush is managing our consumer products. So with 4,500 acres of sustainable farming, we produce a large number of ingredients that fuel this growing sustainable food system that Representative Klim noted the demand is outstripping the supply. So we supply ingredients to many, many brands, hundreds of food brands across the country that are part of this large sustainable food system. And we also have two of our own food brands, Stallbush Island Farms, frozen fruits and vegetables, and we have a line of certified organic canned products. And one of the things that we talk about at the farm as a problem, a great problem to have, but a problem nonetheless, is that our demand outstrips our supply. And training folks in the nuances of sustainable ag and bringing farmers into a new farming system takes an enormous amount of work. I'll give you a couple examples. Right now, the demand for Oregon-grown strawberries across the country, when I sit down with buyers, it so far exceeds what we're able to supply at the farm that I almost don't want them to even taste the strawberry. I know they're going to want to buy these strawberries from us. I know I'm going to go back to the farm and ask for more, and we are going to have a really hard time meeting that demand. What sustainable ag does, and the certification programs in particular do, is they allow us to fetch a premium in the marketplace. And certification really provides a lens back to this farm here in Oregon. It provides an independent third-party oversight, if you will, into what the practices are at the farm. And right now, consumers care about what's happening at the farm. There was about a 30 to 40 year trend stretching from, say, the 40s to the 70s, where consumers wanted the food system concealed. Food came from a store. Well, that has changed, and consumers really want to peer behind the food package and understand where their food is coming from. I was in North Carolina last week talking with a buyer from a store called Ingles. They have 200 stores. And he said the reason he was meeting with me is because we had sustainably grown food grown in the USA. He made a bold declaration that nothing in his freezer cases was grown in China. He was mistaken about his own freezer cases. But what I see across the country is this incredible demand for these sustainable products. And what, more specifically, the OSARC program can do is help us meet that demand, providing the information to other growers so that they can grow the crops to meet that demand. And when I sit down with a buyer at a store like Ingles, I can be very confident when they want our products, I can go ahead and let them know that the supply is going to be there to meet the demand. We have a procurement staff that, is running circles trying to keep up. One other thing I wanted to share is that I sit on a board called the National Organic Standards Board, and this is an appointment made by Mike Johans, the just previous U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, and I had a moment to talk with him about 3 or 4 months ago, and I want to tell you the same thing that I had a chance to tell him, which is that sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture, programs that are certified are really the hope for the family farm in this country. And we see it, it's the key feature of farming in the United States. It's the reason consumers are willing to pay a premium, and we really hope that the OSARC program will come into existence as soon as possible, because we see even in as short a time as a year us falling behind our customer orders. So thank you very much for the moment.
Thank you. Any questions? Mm-hmm. 1 second.
Yeah, just to stand by there, I have a question. Think of two other labels that are used in food marketing. One is the term natural, and the other is the term organic. And my impression is that natural has no discipline, that anybody can call their product, no matter what it is, natural, and they'll sell it and market it that way, whereas under organic, there are standards of certification. How do we make sure that the term sustainable doesn't become more like natural than it does like organic?
Well, you're absolutely right that the term natural, with the exception of some specific meat products, is a non-regulated term. Organic is regulated by the U.S. government. And frankly, sustainability is really hard to codify. We're talking about we're talking about workers' rights. We're talking about protecting the environment. We're talking about human health. And you raise a great point, but that's not, we're not worried about sustainability, I guess, getting diluted if what's actually happening on the farm is being verified by an independent third party. And I guess the example is there's no such thing as natural certification happening right now. There is sustainable certification. Food Alliance does it, a group called Salmon Safe here in Oregon. We have an outfit called Protected Harvest in California. There is a nascent movement right now to actually codify the word sustainable and create a sustainable seal, and we're paying very close attention to see where that goes. The upshot is that the more people who understand sustainability, care about sustainable, care about organic, I guess it's really all boats float higher. It's still only, organic agriculture only accounts for 2% of the food system, and we see that easily going to 10% over the next 10 years. So there's plenty of room to grow in this movement with no dilution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thompson.
I might follow up on that. I mean, my perception is that typically what you'll see is, you know, a little logo that is from a group that's done a certification that is really specific. You got to meet X, Y, and Z. So Food Alliance or Gap or Salmon Safe, and they'll have their own logo. Then somewhere in the product, you might have the company, like the word sustainably happens to be up there, but it's not the feature of it. If we got to the point where people started just making a logo that said sustainably grown and had no meaning, that's when you'd want to get into, you know, making sure it actually had meaning. But typically it's some group or Gap or, you know, it's kind of got a brand name to it. It's probably trademarked in all these cases, and it's got real specific tests with each one.
Yeah, if I may, Tracy described it very well, and I just would underscore that I talked about transparency in one's practices on the farm. For the certifier to have a meaningful definition with verifiable criteria, it's really all about transparency. You know, we learned that the hard way in the Enron debacle, and we're learning that we have to move back to greater transparency in business practices. Well, this is about transparency in the practices of the certifier and the certification body. So for an organization like Food Alliance, we use the S word advisedly. We use it carefully. and not in all contexts. But our certification is what it stands for by the definitions that are embedded in the certification. It starts with a set of guiding principles and moves from criteria to actual conditions that can be observed on the farm. And it's there and available for anyone to see. So the person who reads that can and says, what is this Food Alliance thing, and why should I believe that this product has inherently greater value because that seal is on there? They can go to our website and they can read what conditions the both the farm and the processor had to meet to qualify for the use of that seal. So therein is our definition of what sustainability is in that case. But the verification is really the important point.
So Europe has some standards that they've put in with respect to some of their products that are more global than we have in the U.S., more like our organic standards, I guess, that are U.S. deals. Am I getting that correctly? And we have a number of certifiers. One of the problems that OSARC is that a farmer has to figure out what certifier group they want to be under. I mean, they've got to ferret out who it is and what's going to give them the greatest opportunity. And that's what OSARC is about.
We would love help with harmonizing with European organic standards. Right now, there is no harmonization, and so you have to either change your practices or change your labeling. Right now, I'm going through the process of removing the word organic from labels of pumpkin to be able to sell this in the UK, simply because of the amount of time our compost sat in the field. And but you know, it takes an attorney to get to the answers that you need, and having that specialist in one clearinghouse location to help us have actually composted as long as we needed to so that we could fetch that organic premium in the UK on this one little project would have made more money for the farm, frankly.
In addition to helping farmers with compliance, if that's the appropriate word, with certification, its other role we envision is helping farmers decide which certification may or may not be appropriate for them, depending upon where their markets are. If they have no intention of marketing in Europe, or they only intend to market to Japan but not to Europe. We hope that the resources available at OSARC will help people make that determination. And part of the vision is to house it at the Food Innovation Center, where in addition to OSARC staff, the staff at the center are very familiar with those markets because they do a lot of work with overseas marketing to Japan and to Europe. So they're familiar with that larger context. So if we can marry that expertise with some certification expertise, we think we can really guide growers appropriately so that they can avoid some of these challenges with the different certifications according to markets.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I have a technical question first of Beth. The draft legislative proposal in front of us, where did that come from?
That came from the work group.
The work group.
Yeah.
And both Tracy and the gentleman, you're part of the work group, right?
Tracy was not.
Tracy is not.
Okay, so I'll hold those questions towards the end. But I do have another question, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. Tracy, you mentioned that organic was regulated by the federal government, the term organic. Can you name a specific agency that regulates that, or is that a delegated power to the Oregon Department of Agriculture?
It's regulated under the Agricultural Marketing Service, so AMS, under NOP, and then further down the chain is the Transportation Services, which then houses the National Organic Program.
Okay, great. Thanks. One follow-up question, Chair. Chris, you can jump in if you want to, but I'm looking at the draft legislative proposal, which I have questions on, and the problem when you pass legislation, as the council will agree with me, is that when they go interpret it, God knows what it is we're thinking we said. If you, in a very short statement, could say the single most important function you're trying to get out of this piece of legislation is what? I'm talking to interpret it, not what this says, but the single most important.
I might defer to some of my colleagues who are yet to come. My words would be to provide growers with assistance in selecting and complying with agricultural certification programs.
Great, thank you. That's a loaded question because I'm trying to get you to put it on record so that when we get farther down the line,
yeah.
we say, why are we doing this again?
That, yeah, that's why.
We can get the agencies to agree that, yes, that's what the intent was.
The caveat I would add was something I said before, which is that the technical resources for improving one's environmental or social performance as a grower are important regardless of whether someone is seeking certification or subsequently determines they don't need certification for the markets they're in. They may have a personal desire in increasing the availability and quality of wildlife habitat on their land. They may have a personal interest in better stewarding the soil and water resources available to them on that land, irrespective of their desire for certification. And OSARC is envisioned as a source of technical assistance or referrals for that purpose as well. So I don't want to leave that out.
Thank you, sir. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Roland, committee members, thanks for another opportunity to talk about OSARC. Just for those that I don't know well, my name is Rick Jacobson. I'm the retired, I underscore retired, although it doesn't feel like it, president and CEO of NORPAC. I've been involved in these discussions on OSARC from the outset. At the time the Governor's Oregon Solutions Program gave us an umbrella under which to develop this. Gee, that's a long time ago, and it strikes me shouldn't have been this hard. It seemed like such a simple idea that emanated from a conversation I had with one of our growers. I guess that's probably been 4 or 5 years ago, and it seemed to me like such a simple idea to find a one-stop shop in which a grower could look to that in order to get answers quickly to problems he was facing either for certification or for whatever he was working on. In this particular case, this grower was interested in restoring wetlands, about 60 acres that he was taking out of productions on the Willamette Main Stem. He'd already buffered it for pesticide application under his IPM programs, and he was really interested in restoring these wetlands. Three agencies, different directions, every one of them. He had a difficult time in pulling all this together. So there was kind of the beginning of our involvement in OSARC, thinking we ought to have a way to coordinate the information, expertise, and resources of the state agencies, some of the NGOs we're involved with, and other organizations. It just made sense if you could pick up the phone and say, I want to restore some wetlands. Where do I go? Is there economic assistance available? Is there expertise available? So that was hopefully, Representative Boquist, a direct response to your question. It's a one-stop shop clearinghouse. It's not an agency that we envision anyway. It would be to provide access for a grower to get help to address some of these issues that the markets are requesting of him, as well as public policy. So that's a little off what my testimony was going to be, but given the questions, I wanted to point that out. I do want to make you aware of NORPAC, what we are. As most of you know, we're a processing and marketing cooperative, been in business since 1924. We're owned by 240 family farmers right here in the Willamette Valley, Tualatin Valley, and even grow cauliflower in East Multnomah County, believe it or not. Our growers, family farmers, are producing crops for NORPAC on about 50,000 acres here in the state of Oregon. But that doesn't really talk about what the ideas of certification mean, because on the average, those growers deliver to NORPAC about one-third of their crops. So there's another 66% that are under these whole farm certifications. So their footprint on the Willamette Valley watershed is pretty significant. We market both nationally and internationally, so we're dealing with some of the certification competitive issues in foreign countries. We presently have 70, I was just advised this morning, we have 74 members of NORPAC, family farmers, that have exceeded the audit requirements of our stewardship program, and 25% of those have been certified for at least one crop under Food Alliance. We have a processing facility that has Food Alliance certification. And that kind of, I didn't bring any products with me. I thought about it, but that might be a little too theatrical. But there's a success story. Now that's my competitor. What's he know? Peter's not here, is he?
No. I better be careful.
But there is a success story that we can tell. We've been selling under Flavor Plaque label. Hope you all know what Flavor Plaque is, and you have some in your freezer. We've been selling Flavor Plaque beans that have been imported from France, small seed whole beans, believe it or not, because they're not grown here in the United States. In recent years, we learned how to produce those beans. We presently have those beans certified under Food Alliance, selling into Costco under a sustainable label. So today we have literally millions of pounds of beans that have historically been imported from France, now grown here in the Willamette Valley and being marketed out of Oregon into Costco throughout the United States. I think that's a great success story and the power of what the market can do if you respond affirmatively to those opportunities. Believe me, in a company like NORPAC, it's owned by farmers since 1924, making a change like this has not been easy. But they see the value of responding to both the public pressure and the market pressure about how we produce our crops, how we treat the people that harvest those crops, and how we treat the environment, the fish and wildlife. It makes a difference. So I guess if you look at Ozark, if we are through public policy, and that's occurring, you folks get involved in that a lot, and through market pressures, if we're going to expect private businesses, farmers and ranchers in this case, to respond to these kinds of pressures, I think we have an equal responsibility to provide an easy access to the resources and the expertise that we've spent millions of dollars in this state creating. The original Ozark is not totally encompassed in this bill. There's been 27 different folks involved in the original declaration. There's an awful lot of work that's gone on in the content of that. A lot of goodwill has been created. So it's not complete what we had hoped in terms of websites and so forth, but it's a start. And that's really what I look at this bill as a beginning. It's created a lot of goodwill. It's proven to me from the private sector, born and raised in Eastern Oregon, so that'll give you a little insight into probably my political views. It's been really an interesting thing to find out that the regulatory community, the private sector, those folks that are really interested in what we're doing out there on the farm and the processing can actually sit down, work together, and start to find some solutions in a positive way. And I think that benefits agriculture, and it sure benefits a company like NORPAC, and thus, I think, the state of Oregon. The bottom line, I think we're all working in the best interests of the farmers. And I believe that Ozark is just one of those ways that we can help them respond to these changing market conditions, and we can make Oregon competitive on the basis of its good reputation. I mean, you go into Florida, and people find out you're from Oregon, they think, you know, that's the green state. Well, yes, it is, except 60% of it's desert. But it's a great way, and, you know, they believe in our products. It's a great way to market Oregon. And it's good for businesses like ourselves, Stavrovich and Truett Brothers. And there's not a lot of us left, to be quite frank with you. I think the other thing that's in this bill is we have a plan. In December of 2008, OSARC will report back to the legislature in terms of what our technical needs are and what information needs that growers are going to have so that we can take the next step in terms of web access and those kinds of things. There's some tremendous amount of information that's coming out of OSU. I think it's critical to farmers that somehow we've got to be able to circulate faster and with some clarity. yeah, I think it just makes sense over the long term to deliver these kinds of things. You're going to hear a lot today about the value and benefits of developing this clearinghouse that I'm talking about. I think this is an important moment in time for agriculture in Oregon. If the public looks to farmers and ranchers, both through public policy and market pressure, to adapt their practices to meet the objectives of sustainability, one only has to look at the rather rigorous criteria that growers are asked to fulfill to meet Food and Land certification, then I suggest that we have an obligation to provide at least a one-stop-shop clearinghouse so they can seek their help. This brings together really, and Scott mentioned this, a diverse group of people who want a strong, sustainable ag sector, which I think is good for Oregon. It's a small investment that leverages literally millions of dollars that we spend in this state and the federal level, NRCS, soil water, fish and wildlife, and the list is long. So it leverages all of those things and brings to bear that assistance to growers. So I urge this committee to support this rather simple effort, in my opinion. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you're an independent now, you can answer this question. This is actually a technical question, and I'll pass it to you because you have more experience than the Department of Agriculture has, and very supportive of this effort. I'm just looking at a couple things. I won't mention on the record who provided this can, but there's a can of natural product here that has a shelf life of 2 years. Is there any danger from a marketing perspective and from a canning perspective that we could have the Department of Agriculture quasi-certifying third-party certifiers who certify the product? It has a shorter shelf life than other products normally. It goes overseas, goes bad on us, and then we get a black eye, or they come back on us and say, you know, you guys are certifying this product, and, you know, it didn't, you know, container got lost, it went bad, so on and so forth. Obviously, the shelf life of this type of product is less than that of that has MSG and everything else that glows in the dark and makes you last forever.
Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah. Right.
First of all, I always would argue with those that tell us you're going to have a shelf life on a shelf-stable product like that, which we do. We have a 2-year shelf life on our canned products also. But that's the processor's responsibility. We better not overpack. That will come back to us. And if it's, and your question is, does the idea of sustainability reduce the shelf life? No, it does not, particularly on a canned product.
Okay.
That's a food safety issue that you're talking about there.
Right. Great.
Other questions?
Just maybe one. First, I want to thank Rick. I know he is supposed to be retired, but he's been at all these meetings still post-retirement, and this project needed shepherds, so thank you very much. One thing, and I just didn't get to ask Scott this, but from the grower side of it, is it the case that with some certification organizations, they're really acting in a judicial role almost, judging whether you meet criteria, and so you can't necessarily ask them to also help you meet all the criteria in more of a consultative role because they're supposed to be judging you, not helping you, and that's why we need sort of an independent entity to also help meet certifications if you know, necessary.
Yeah, that would be the Arthur Anderson predicament. You're auditing as well as recommending, that can be a problem. So you're correct. The one thing I want to leave you with this thought. When NORPAC got into it, we knew that the market's demanding this. I mean, all you got to do is look at the Sodexos of the world and the Walmarts, and the list is long. They're saying thou shalt. So we knew we had to get into this, and not just NORPAC. This is across the industry, across the United States. So now we're going to go to our growers and we're going to say, these are the things that we need to do. Now we're suggesting the market's imposing on them some different ways of doing business, and public policy is accomplishing the same thing. So how do we help them get over these hurdles? A lot of the things, integrated pest management has become standard business within agriculture. We've been doing that for 10, 15 years, so that's not something new. But when you start talking about fish and wildlife issues on the farm, there's some new things there. So how would a company like NORPAC or Truett's help? Don't have the expertise. So the simple idea here was, is let's use those resources that are already employed in the state and make sure they have easy access to them to help them in a consultative way rather than a regulatory way. And that's kind of how this whole thing started. So, again, I ask again for your support. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. It's my pleasure to talk about the Ozark proposal. I just want to say Farm Bureau doesn't yet officially have a position on the bill going into 08. We'll be discussing this at our December board meeting. But talking to our members, certification is becoming more of an important discussion. And we're seeing the same needs that you've been hearing this morning about, that this is really becoming market entrance, not a value added, you're going to get more for your product, but really a need that many of my members are needing to enter into to stay so they can continue to sell their products to Safeway and to Costco and the food distributors and the food processors. As an example, I have a member in the Woodburn area that grows flowers, and last year they weren't able to get their certification paperwork done in time, and they were ended up having $100,000 worth of flowers that they couldn't sell into the Safeway market. And this morning we've been talking about mainly food products, but really non-food products also are requiring third-party certification. Farm Bureau in the past has had concerns with the Ozark concept. However, I would say that this legislation is moving into an area that makes my members much more comfortable. And some of the pieces are the survey that the executive director that's hired with the funds would go out and do to see what the needs are out there in the agriculture community and talk to growers on how they want to interact with Ozark and get the information and what is the information that they're seeking. The other portion that's very important that we're seeing a greater need for is the two positions that would be ODA marketing staff that would assist people who are interested in certification, but they don't really know what avenue they want to go to. So they know that they're raising green beans under these practices in their normal traditional markets are in a certain area. So they can go to the ODA and ask, what programs could I fit into? If there's not a program there, there might be a potential to create one for that industry. We're seeing that with the Christmas tree industry right now. Growers are coming together to start a certification program. So those positions really could interact with growers and get serve as a clearinghouse on what certification programs are available to them. Additionally, we see those positions as serving as advocates as well on certification and agriculture industry. So interacting with the buyers. So there's an understanding at Safeway and Costco on what each organizations are doing, what growers are doing, and also hopefully preventing or trying their best to prevent situations in Oregon where Costco's requiring certain standards, Safeway's requiring different, and Fred Meyer's a totally different set of standards. So growers are then forced in a position where they have to either pick or choose or do three different certification programs, which would be costly, timely, and probably more of an incentive than an incentive to get things done. So we're very grateful for the work that Representative Clem's done and others on kind of bringing the groups together, having some dialogue during this interim, and hopefully bringing together a very good proposal for the 08 session. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We'll go for the next person, and then we'll ask together.
I'm Allison Henze. I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. Chair Roble and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today about an important proposal. And I have to say, it's a pleasure to be sitting here with Katie from the Farm Bureau and advocating jointly for this proposal. Well, you've already heard a lot about the opportunities for growers, both of food and other products, to get a price premium with certification. I agree with Katie that some markets are simply requiring it. It's an opportunity to expand your market, but it's also an opportunity for a price premium. I was at Safeway last night, and this can of organic green beans cost $1.59, and this can of non-organic green beans cost 95 cents. And you know that the growers of those green beans are getting some of that difference. And I want Oregon's agricultural community to have an opportunity to participate in that price difference for a couple of reasons. One is to support the continued viability of family farms in Oregon so that the next generation wants to go into this business and so that we continue to grow great food and other products here and have viable rural communities. And the other is to provide financial incentives and the financial ability for the agricultural community to help protect our water quality and our fish and wildlife habitat, where before they might not have had those resources. With an ongoing market incentive, they might have that ability. We invest a lot of money as a state in regulation of the agricultural community and their effects on water quality and wildlife habitat, and we have significant grant programs that provide assistance to folks to shepherd those resources and be good environmental stewards. Through the establishment of OSARC, we have the opportunity, through the investment of a relatively small amount of money, to leverage the resources we have in the state in terms of knowledge and technical assistance for better stewardship of agricultural lands, and connect people with markets that will provide an ongoing financial incentive that will allow them to improve their stewardship and have it make economic sense as well. And I think it's a win-win for everybody. So the Oregon Environmental Council is in strong support of this proposal. We, as a work group, I think will continue to talk about exactly what OSARC should look like as an entity to be most effective and accomplish its goals. But I think it's an exceptional group of people of diverse interests who are all coming together to say this is important to do.
Okay. Questions? I think we're okay. Thank you both.
Hi there, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Wist. I'm the Quality Assurance Food Safety Manager at Scenic Fruit Company in Gresham, Oregon. We process 10 to 15 million pounds of fruits and vegetables grown here in the Willamette Valley each year. And we additionally handle another 10 to 15 million pounds of fruits and vegetables that have been processed initially at another processor by reformatting them or changing composition or pack size. We were started in 1931 when the Lauterbach family bought the scenic trolley stop when the Bull Run train line went out of was decommissioned. They started packing strawberries there for the Portland market. The same family has been doing that in the same facility, well, we've built onto it, since 1931. Mary Dean Isley, the current owner and granddaughter of the Lauterbachs, has taken the company into new directions and really wants to help decommodify the fruit products and vegetable products we handle. We're certified organic by Oregon Tilth. We have been since the adoption of the National Organic Program. We are the third processor to be certified under the Food Alliance Handler Standard for sustainability. We did so originally because a customer of ours requested that we look into it. Well, we wanted to please our customer. We also recognize that there is an opportunity here to diversify our marketability of our products. At first, we had two growers who were certified. Last year, this harvest, we had four growers who were certified under the Food Alliance standard. We have only one grower who's certified organic, but 2 years ago, we had two growers, and before that, we had three or four growers. It's becoming difficult for some growers to maintain organic certification, and sustainability certification is becoming easier. We'd like to handle more and more of those commodities because certified commodities sell. Tracy mentioned earlier that strawberries, Oregon strawberries, are high demand across the nation. Well, that's not always the case. We sold out of our certified sustainable strawberries prior to having all of them packed. We're still sitting on a truckload of 4+1 strawberries, which are typically used in ice cream. because our ice cream buyers have gone to a California berry because consumer marketing studies show that the white-centered berry is more appealing than the Oregon dark-centered berry. Because California has the capability to flood the market, they're changing consumer perceptions of what a strawberry should look like. Mm. So sustainability sells, conventional still sitting in our freezer. Why do we support Ozark? Well, one of the things that Mary Dean asked me several times when we were working on the Food Alliance certification and organic certification and compliance in general with food safety regulations and all sorts of changing expectations in the marketplaces, she asked me, why do we have to reinvent the wheel? Because there's always something new that we have to refigure out. Well, we don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel, but we do have to select the appropriate tire for the journey that we're driving on and the vehicle that we have to drive with. We see Ozark as being sort of a Les Schwab of sustainability.
It's a great tire, Mr. Chairman. Great tire.
And provide a selection to growers of a variety of agricultural commodities, be they food products, timber products, fiber products. And I know that there's also some things going on with biofuels in Oregon nowadays. If there are these kind of opportunities that the state supplies, Oregon will be seen as a leader in sustainable agriculture. More buyers will come to Oregon for a variety of different products. So it seems like it'd be a good opportunity for all Oregon growers. And on that note, there's been a lot of focus on sustainability certification or certification in general. Certified products do sell, but it may not be the best fit for all growers or processors. Ozark would provide an opportunity for growers and processors to try it on without having a large investment. They could look at specific programs, they could look at what their initial investment would be, and start making steps and telling stories and getting buyers like Bon Appetit and Sodexo to start taking in their products without having to make the full commitment to certification all at once. It's just a toolkit. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Great analysis.
Oregon grown.
Exactly, Oregon grown. I think that is all of the testimony. Is there anyone else here that was in that group that wants to say anything? Well, I want to thank everyone for that one. Do you want to give us a preview of the...
Mr. Chair, I can go through the legislative concept, if that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. You should have in front of you a 4-page draft. This is the product that the work group came up with, and I've been mentioned by a couple of the members of the work group. There may be some additional tweaking to this concept, but I think there was general agreement with what you see in front of you. So just very briefly, Section 1 is a finding section that lays out the reasons for creating Ozark. Further down that first page, starting at line 12, Ozark is created within the Department of Agriculture, and the draft lays out three main purposes of the center. First, to serve as a source and clearinghouse for education, information, and technical support for producers who are wanting to voluntarily certify their farms and ranches. Second, to provide information and technical support on sustainable ag production to both producers and to resource professionals. And then third, to provide marketing and assistance to farmers and ranchers. Section 3 of the draft creates an advisory board to advise the State Board of Agriculture. The board consists of 11 voting members and 4 ex officio non-voting members. Starting on line 5, I guess on line 8, the voting membership is laid out there. It's a diverse group of people, including growers, including certifiers, people with experience in marketing of sustainable ag products, someone to represent grocers. You can read through the entire list, but it's a diverse group of folks who are interested in this issue. The rest of that page deals with selecting the chair and vice chair, the terms of office. If you go to page 3, beginning on line 5, are the ex officio members of the advisory board. They include the dean of the College of Ag Sciences at OSU, the director of the Extension Service, the director of the Food Industry Leadership Center at Portland State, and then also the state conservationist or his or her designee with NRCS. Section 5 are the terms of office for the advisory board. Section 6 is a quorum requirement. Page 4, starting on line 5, lays out what the role of the advisory board is. First is to survey producers, to ask them not only what their information needs are, but what the vehicle to deliver that information would be most effective for them, to recommend goals and priorities for the resource center to the director of the Department of Ag, to measure whether or not the center is used, how much it's used, and what way it's used by the producers, and then to also engage a network of agencies and organizations to contribute information and expertise to the center. And then on line 17 is the required report that was mentioned earlier to the 09 legislative session to describe what's happened and what the role of the center has been so far. And then section 10 is the appropriation section.
Suggestions? Anything else that came to mind? Okay. Represented both of us.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I had a comment. I mean, if I were voting, and I'll explain, if I were voting today and this was a bill, I'd be an absolute no vote. I'm 100% with everybody sitting out there that we needed to do something yesterday. What challenges me is that, as you and I have, this is the third term that we've been on this committee together, and I've carried bills on the floor, and I could show you bills that you've carried on the floor that we have passed, and various agencies have done a 90-degree turn left or right or 180-degree turn when the bill hit the administrative rule portion. To complement the Department of Agriculture, they are both a regulatory agency and an assisting agency, and in my mind, one of the few agencies that does do that. But what is lacking in the testimony, and the reason I asked the question up front of what is the single focus point, is as we go forward with this, and I'll be a yes vote to send this to drafting and bring it forward, is we need to have the Department of Agriculture come testify and concur with all the testimony we heard here so that we have them on record and that we keep them honest. And I said they are a very honest agency and they've done a real good job, but we do have agencies that do 180 turns on us. And I think it would behoove the committee in the future, as we hear this in the session, that they come concur with everybody that's here and we're sure that everybody's on the same sheet of music so that we have it on the records when we go to rulemaking, because I envision this will pass, that we know what the legislative intent was. The agency, should the agency director or the drafters of the administrative rules change from the working group, it is on the record that they concurred with the concept and the implementation as we saw it here in the legislature. So I'll be a yes vote as we push it forward, but I think we absolutely need to have the Department of Agriculture testify at some point to get them on record that they are on board with the work group.
I have a question for staff, Mr. Chair. Ms. Petrino, the text of this, has this gone through, been generated by Legislative Council or come through? Mm-hmm. This is from outside, and so what we would be are being asked to do today is to send this to Legislative
That's
Council.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. I don't need to fuss over some language issues. I would just note that in Section 2, which is the most operative provision of the term sustainable, only appears one place in Subsection 3, and mm-hmm. so I think there's some tightening up of language that needs to be done.
Okay.
Could ask Lauren. We do have somebody from Ag here if they would like to come forward. Have you been part? Yeah, come on up.
He's been at the work group.
And I guess while he's coming up here, the thing I would say is that I have found that if you really want, as you hear the testimony, this is about a resource, not about a regulating agency. And I see a lot of heads nodding. And I, from my perspective, that's what I see this too, is as having a resource to this group out there, finding out what they need and then helping provide that resource so people can make informed decisions about things. And it's not saying we're going to regulate everybody to these standards. It's saying here's the information. And I feel pretty strongly that that's really the best way to move things. Markets move things, so do others, and it's not the regulation that moves them. It's the fact that everybody needs to get there because we want to comply because we want to meet these standards. And you don't need a whole lot of people to go out and check it all the time if they're really all working towards that kind of thing. And I, I, I think that's kind of what you're saying,
right,
as well.
Exactly.
And I have to comment as well that all of my dealings with the Department of Ag have been very good that way, because I do see them doing both sides and having and splitting that pretty well. So anyway, with Lauren, any idea? Have you been involved in the?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, we have been involved from somewhere the onset of this whole thing, more recently in the drafting of this legislation. The Department of Ag is in full support of what's written here and what you have. I think this is a wonderful thing. It's been said already how many different groups of folks have gotten together in this Solutions Project and come together with a common purpose, and it's exactly what you just said, Chair Roland. This is a resource. This is voluntary. People don't have to do this if they don't want to. This is just a mechanism to pull lots of toolkits together into one big toolkit for folks to be able to call, be able to be referred, whether that's to the Department of Ag or a public sector, private sector partnership that has been formed. That's what this is about, and we understand that and are in full support of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I fully appreciate the Department of Agriculture as being one of those agencies in which we have a great working relationship. I've twice served as the vice chair of this committee, and with one exception, the department director and I agree on virtually everything. But having said that, are you comfortable as a representative of the Department of Agriculture that you have staff that have been involved in the entire process, that when we come to rulemaking, when this passes, and I'm being optimistic, that there is adequate staff that are familiar with the entire workings, that the administrative rules and implementation comes out in a manner that is consistent with what the broad working group wants to accomplish?
Representing Boquist, actually I am. And the reason why I am is the advisory group will be the ones drafting those rules. It will not be the Department of Ag. We will be part of that, but like we do everything at the Department of Ag, we involve our stakeholders in those rules. I do not anticipate that we will adopt anything that advisory group has not put its hand on and the bigger group.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so that's one of the issues. We will now move on to... pardon? We'll take a short break so we can set up a PowerPoint for the Water Supply Conservation Initiative. We're going to, and we didn't get the PowerPoint to work, so we do have some copies of a PowerPoint presentation. And with that, I will turn it over to our committee administrator to kind of introduce the people coming.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barry Norris and Debbie Colbert from the Water Resources Department are here to talk about the Water Supply Initiative.
How long do we have?
15.
Okay.
This is the PowerPoint.
Yep.
Good morning, and thank you very much for giving us some time on your agenda today. Again, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert. I'm with the Water Resources Department, and we wanted to just do a little bit of follow-up with the committee, tell you about the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. This was an initiative that the governor proposed last session for our budget, and the legislature chose to fund. It's about $800,000 for the biennium, and it includes five elements that are designed to get at what are our long-term water supply needs in Oregon, and what are our opportunities to meet those needs. Barry Norris is here. He's our state engineer, and he is leading our efforts in implementing this project. He's here today to tell you a little bit about some of the key drivers that were behind this budget package and to give you the up-to-the-minute kind of implementation activities. And we also would note that we were directed to report to interim committees, so we really do appreciate this opportunity to fill you in.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Barry Norris, engineer with the Water Resources Department. I apologize that I didn't get the CD written correctly and make it available for PowerPoint, but I did bring the copies of the PowerPoint over, and if you'll just follow with me through a few of these slides, we won't talk about all of them in the interest of time, but there are a couple points, as Debbie said, that I'd like to make. First of all, falling down the left-hand side of the slides, are six to a page, our summer flow in Oregon is fully appropriated. Oregon Water Resource Department appropriates live flow on an 80% exceedance, and virtually during the irrigation season, surface water is pretty much no longer available for any appropriation of any significance. However, there is winter flow available, which means there'd be winter flow possibly available for storage after consideration for other needs. In addition, the upper right-hand side, then, we have a number of restricted groundwater areas in Oregon. So groundwater is getting more scarce and more scarce, and that one of the driving factors of that is the hydraulic connection between surface water and groundwater. If there is no surface water available and groundwater is connected, then surface water becomes a problem as well. Now, recently, the fourth slide, the transient snowpack slide, recently we participated in a study in Oregon to plot what's called a transient snowpack in Oregon, and that is the snowpack at essentially mid-elevation that it would be most susceptible to a warming trend in the climate. And as you can see from that, the darker area is the transient snowpack, defined as a transient snowpack. It comprises 57% of the area in Oregon. And so a lot of the wintertime or summertime flows, as well as getting into the, well, early in the season, early runoff and through the season, is dependent on this snowpack storage in the form of snow. And so as the climate warms, that storage is no longer going to be available, or a large part of that storage will no longer be available for users in Oregon, both east and on the west side of the Cascades. Now, this water supply initiative addresses critical needs, the dwindling sources for new supply in Oregon. So moving on to the next page, you can see the initiative components: assessment of existing water supply needs, analysis of conservation opportunities, inventory of potential storage sites, basin yield estimates, and finally some match funding for community and regional water supply planning. This initiative was funded during the last session, and we are on our way implementing that water supply initiative. Speaking to the water needs assessment first, we've issued a notice or a request for proposal, and that portion of the project will consider municipal and industrial and domestic supplies, agricultural, irrigation, livestock, in-stream fish and recreation, and power and storage to develop a needs assessment for the 18 major basins for those categories. The water needs assessment is going to start the 1st of December. We've reviewed the proposals, and we've selected a contractor, and we expect to sign the contract and issue a notice to proceed on the 1st of December. We'll begin with a kickoff meeting and then completion on June 26th of 2008. It'll include an assessment of water needs statewide. It'll identify existing supply issues, economic trends, and population trends. And it'll wind up with a database that, again, will address the 18 major water basins, management basins, that'll be, as well as some scenarios that people can run based on their expectations of population trends, economic trends, and those kinds of things, so that we can start to define accuracy of the projections. So it'll be a database that'll have scenarios to run for future supplies. The conservation part is similar, and it's we issued a request for proposals. It's statewide. It'll include contacts for the various organizations and conservation groups and municipal suppliers. The object of it is to develop an inventory of conservation projects. Again, it'll consist of a review of existing materials. It'll be outreach contacts to all the water users around the state, the water user groups, and then we'll target specific groups where there's expectation that there'll be a high demand in that area, or there is a severe lack of water in that area, and depending on economic trends as well. So that's kind of the framework for the conservation project to develop that database. Again, it'll have a kickoff meeting on December 11th, and we expect to be completed by July 1 of 2008. For the next portion of the supply initiative, we're doing an inventory of surface water storage sites around the state. we're looking at on a statewide basis. We've already done a considerable amount of work inventorying the identified storage sites. In the bottom right-hand corner of page 3 of the slide, you'll see the Umatilla Basin. The existing sites that have been identified are noted with triangles on that slide. The idea will be to click on those sites, an interactive mapping database, so that you'll be able to click on those individual triangles. If you'll turn the page, you'll see a whole host of the type of information that will be available for people to review and look at those sites and see what information's been developed for those sites. Everything from site attributes, watershed characteristics, area capacity curves for those sites, GIS mapping, topography, geology, photographs, any reports that have been written. I'm on page 5 now. Watershed characteristics, and so on. No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm reading off the wrong one.
We got it. I'm excited.
Another component of that is below ground storage. Taking water, live flow water during the winter months, and putting it into, injecting it into wells and storing it below ground, and then removing it when it's needed later. There's a slide that shows a typical aquifer storage and recovery site for a municipality where they can treat the water from a surface water source, use it as needed, or divert it for winter time, during the winter time when there's surplus surface water storage, inject it down a well and then remove it back out of the well during the summer months when there's a higher demand and use it that way. And we're underway with that project. We have identified a number of municipalities around the state. You can see a slide of the state with below ground storage, preliminary result for municipal ASR suitability. And we've categorized that into three categories of the potential for low or medium or very good potential. We're going to move also, we're moving into agricultural uses, looking at the state in total. We'll be identifying in aquifer characteristics as well as water availability. You can see our timeline is for completion a year from now. Another component of the water supply initiative was water availability basins, or identify the amount of water that might be available for storage during the winter months. That part of the initiative was not funded. However, we're proceeding with it as best we can on our own, and it's probably 2 to 3 years out for completion. It's going to take some time because we don't have additional resources. So those are four of the components, and I guess I'd turn it over to Debbie now to talk a little bit about the matching funds for local planning.
That's the last component of this supply initiative, and it's something that we added to our initiative based on what we heard as we went around the state to talk about this. And it's about $200,000 for us to provide match funding to communities and regions that are trying to think about what their long-term water supply needs are. And so we are taking some draft criteria for how we would award those funds to our commission in November to get their input on how they'd like to prioritize those funding sources, and then we're hoping to make a request for proposal sometime after January to start awarding those funds as well. And I guess just to close, we see these five elements in the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative as setting the foundation, and hopefully in 2009, for the state to discuss what we've learned and what kinds of key investments or efforts we need to be pursuing as a state to really ensure of the long term that we have the right strategies for meeting our long term water supply needs.
Some questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two questions. The first question is just clarification. You mentioned the water availability basin study has not been funded. Isn't there kind of a correlation between an allocated winter flow? I mean, don't we go out first to figure out what we have before we figure out how to store it? That's question one. And then the second question I have is really, a philosophical response, because you're not a lawyer, but it seems to me that that underground storage is better than surface water storage, simply from the perspective that judges typically order us to release surface water for other reasons, and we obviously can't, he's not in a position to make us pump it out of the ground. So is there a preference over surface, and I'm talking specifically about salmon and fish, versus underground, and then what's the correlation between water availability and do we have the horse before the cart or the cart before the horse? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, first of all, addressing the water availability, we think it's a very important part of the supply initiative as well, and that's why we're doing what we can to proceed on our own without additional resources. We have completed a water availability analysis, and we maintain that database. We started back in the early 90s, I believe, and have constantly upgraded it. But that water availability database looks at live flow in terms of cubic feet per second. This would and so it's on an instantaneous basis, and as you know, we get some flood flows parts of the month and then some lower flows parts of the month. So an exceedance flow or an average flow or an exceedance flow, as this database is, really doesn't represent total basin yield, as you point out. And so we do have some good understanding of the amount of water that's produced in a basin as a result of this water availability that we have showing exceedance flows for the month. For instance, an 80% exceedance, half the time it's met or exceeded. But we do need to continue on with basin yield and include that as part of the total package. Now, addressing the underground storage, you're absolutely right. It's a great technology for storage of winter flow for saving it for when you need it later on, when the geology's right. For instance, is there an adequate volume within the aquifer to store the water without increasing spring flows or causing problems elsewhere? Does the water stay in that area long enough for a economic recovery of the amount of water that was treated and stored? And I guess the third important factor is there an ability, is the technology there to treat the surface water so that it doesn't degrade the groundwater? And that's important. And you can actually, when all those three things are working for you, you can probably build a groundwater storage facility for just a fraction of what the surface water storage facility might cost.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Obviously, storing water from the farm perspective, storing water is a great thing, and using it, and we all agree with that, and I think everyone wants to do that. However, I mean, just my observation in the last 50 years, I don't think we've built any, in the modern portion of those 50 years, I don't think we've built any new dams. Dams are kind of hard to build. We have.
I built one.
You built one.
Yeah, Coos Bay Waterboard. We built a dam.
Years ago. Yeah, and then the second challenge becomes is once you do build the dam is that the water can be diverted for other things than what we intended it at the Oregon Water Board and things like that. And so we might be, well, it is a good thing across the board. It might not end up with the intended user even in the end.
So. Yeah, and the real comment that I have is we looked at underground storage as well at the water board I was on, and the issue is getting it in the correct condition of the water to put back into the ground and not having chemicals that will degrade the other water that's already down there, but getting the stuff out of it that you want out of it before you put it in. So that is a big issue, and figuring it out. And I have seen some good work on that being done in the Pendleton area and others now. So it looks like the technology is catching up with us there. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about this slide at the top of page 10 about aquifer storage and recovery. What is it that causes makes the existing groundwater poorer than the water that's coming down the source?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, this is just a representative slide of a possible condition. We're not saying that it's typical of poorer quality, but what it does illustrate is that once the water is treated and it's potable, treated water that for human consumption, it may be of a higher quality, but when what you're looking for in the geology of the of the project is that the water will mound and stay in immediate vicinity of the well so that it can be pulled out at a later date. And so if you do have a poor quality groundwater, perhaps, that you don't want to have to pull up and then treat again, but you're using it for ASR, under the right conditions, you can still store it in that aquifer and then retrieve it later that summer or possibly 2 years later, depending again on the geology, and get that higher quality water back.
You've got water in the Oregon Dunes, for example. Big bowl saves a lot of water, but it's very high in iron. I mean, it is extremely high in iron.
So natural minerals are what is reducing that quality, which, of course, those...
So when you take it back out, you got to get that out.
Grew up on well water in the Willamette Valley are very accustomed to.
Yeah. All right, I'm representative.
Yeah, but you refer to that. I mean, we had the same problem at Polk County where we really don't have a, quote, water problem. What we have is a saline and mineral problem. So as water cables go up and down, if the water gets to a certain height, suddenly we start getting cross-contamination into the wells. And, you know, I'm a living example. I think of the 10 wells within 4 or 5 miles of where, or about 3 or 4 miles where I live, I think 7 have so much salt in them you can't use them. Mm-hmm. And so...
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just put a plug in on the aquifer storage and recovery, we are working on co-hosting a workshop at Oregon State University in February of 2008, try to bring in experts from around the state to talk about, feasibility limitations, how to make ASR work, and understand where it's most appropriate. So we're working on putting that workshop together now.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you for the report, and as I have told so many people since I've come here, that the issue of the future in all of our states is going to be water and the availability of it. And so we do need to be on track with making sure we get the studies, know what's there, because they do change. Climate changes can cause, like you're saying, with the snowpack storage, all sorts of issues. But in the final analysis, we have to have water to have life, and therefore figuring it out is going to be important. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And next we will hear from Katie Fast and Amanda Rich on House Bill 3203 and 2007. And we know this will be quick.
Good morning, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time today. And I am Amanda Rich with the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and Katie and I are here today representing a coalition, actually, of folks. We call ourselves the Coalition for Smart Water Planning, and we consist of the Oregon Water Resources Congress, the League of Cities, the Special Districts Association of Oregon, the Farm Bureau, and the Oregon Association of Nurseries. And we came together as a group prior to last session to devise a solution to a problem that our members had brought to us. And part of a lot of that problem you've heard today in the discussion with the Water Resources Department is that we have a dwindling, changing, uncertain water supply, and we have to get smart about the way that we're using our water. And that means doing innovative conservation and reuse programs, and that means doing smart water storage, smart environmentally sound water storage programs, so that we can shore up our supply now and into the future. And however, we've discovered that in order to do that, you can have great ideas for projects, and in fact across the state we have great ideas for these types of projects. You've seen the dots on the map. We've talked about how we're doing an inventory that identifies some of these potential projects, but the problem is that getting from I have a great idea to putting a shovel in the ground or putting pipe in the ground or whatever it is that needs to happen in order to make your project happen, there's a lot of studying, there's a lot of analysis that goes on in between that point of I've got a great idea, I'm going to conserve water, I'm going to store water, to actually being able to do that. And it's that gap. It's that area in between where there's a real lack of funds, both for private users, public users, tribal entities, folks across the state who are dealing with water. And our coalition represents that broad array. That money isn't there for doing those types of analyses. And so we have devised a solution, and Katie's going to talk to you about that. But real quickly, I'm hoping that you have a packet in front of you. And you have our one-pager that kind of lays out a little bit of what we're talking about here. And then right behind that, you'll see the early results of a survey is an ongoing survey that we're conducting and compiling here of some of the projects that are around the state that would be eligible for the fund that we're proposing to you today. And that you'll find that survey, some of the early results of the survey in this document here. We've got it divided up by conservation projects on the first page, reuse projects, second page, and then the remaining pages are supply and storage projects. And they run the gamut from very small to relatively ambitious projects in terms of storing water, finding water, conserving, reusing. And, again, across the state. So we've got these projects, we've got the initiative, we have the need, and so now we need the solution. And I think I'm going to turn it over to Katie now to tell you a little bit about the solution we've come up with.
Thank you. For the record, once again, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Our coalition is proposing legislation for the 08 supplemental session, and it's really building off legislation some of you might be familiar with that was not successful last session, and that's House Bill 3203, which actually Representative Clem was a co-sponsor of. But this legislation, we're not making a request to this committee. It will be introduced on the Senate side, actually. And it would set up a fund similar to what's already in Water Resources Department, similar to the Drinking Water Fund in administration. But that fund would grant up to $500,000 per project with a 50% match requirement, so dollar for dollar match, that would be available to public bodies, tribal interests, non-government organizations, and private interests. And those grant funds could be used for, and we have actually supplied a copy of the legislation, but it would be used for feasibility, needs analysis, and environmental analysis that is required for many of these projects to get off the ground. And a lot of what we're seeing is getting through the ESA NEPA analysis is one of the major hurdles for some of these projects. So there is a list. Additionally, climate change analysis and the project's impacts due to climate change would also be an approved grant proposal for the funding. We have actually tied this to the Conservation and Supply Initiative of Water Resources Department, so projects identified in those proposals would be given priority ranking, and Water Resources Department would be charged with setting up administrative rules on managing that analysis and ranking process. For larger storage projects, they would actually go through a higher tier of analysis required, and that would be mainly on the environmental side, and part of that would be looking at feasibility of in-stream component as well. And I'd like to give an example just on the ground what some of my members are going through looking at water supply issues and some of the issues they're facing. East Valley Irrigation District, which actually Representative Clem has toured, and I would invite any of you interested in going out and taking a look. They're located in Marion and Clackamas County, Mount Angel, Silverton areas. They represent about 70 irrigators who have come together and formed the irrigation district without water to tackle supply issues they're in. They are actually in three groundwater limited areas, and they're operating, many of them, on time-limited permits. So they have to come up and reapply. Some of those permits have issued denials on reapplication. Some of them have constraints that tell them to go out and look for other water supplies besides their groundwater permit. They've been working on a storage project for over 10 years. They're actually on their third site. Because of going through the environmental analysis and the feasibility studies, they've had to move from site to site because one just isn't feasible to move forward. This has cost them $700,000 of their own dollars, spread over 70 irrigators, for, again, no water. And they probably have $1 million still that they're going to need to invest in before they can start their shovel. They have a site that looks like it's feasible to move forward on, and this investment's for about 12,000 acre feet of water. So it's a huge investment on what is a large amount of water, but it's really, when you look at the size of the area it's going to be covering, it's not that large of a reservoir. So this is just one example of what's going on in the state right now, of people putting their own investment in. But for this project to move forward, they need some help. There's other ones, a whole list, that need some assistance to move forward. And water supply, I think, is going to be probably one of Oregon's most critical issues in the future. And if we look at our neighboring states, we're really behind the curve. Washington has invested $220 million by their legislature to look at water feasibility and analysis in the Columbia River area, and those are new storage projects, but that's just on the feasibility studies that we're talking, $220 million. And California right now is in a special session currently to tackle water issues, and they're looking at making billions of dollars investment in supply issues and supply solutions for California. So it's really time, in our opinion, for Oregon to step up and help these projects get forward before people decide that they can no longer be part of agriculture or be part of industry because they don't have that critical water mass. And with that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I'll say Idaho, actually, on their groundwater studies and other kinds of stuff, are a little bit ahead of us as well.
I would agree.
We're surrounded.
Add that to our paper.
Okay. I see no questions. And thank you very much for giving us the heads up on this legislation. So we are now entering the part of our day when we go into a work session to kind of come up with the bills that we want. So I will, I'll move us. We'll end our informational meetings and we'll open a work session with regard to coming up with the concepts or our concept that we want to send. I guess the big issues that I have been given when we're deciding this is it necessary that it happen now? So is there an immediate need? And I think if you look at all three of ours, there are, and we'll talk about those in a second. The other one that's going to, that it will impact it has to do with, and is it something that's bipartisan that all of us can kind of agree on? So those are two of the big concepts. Another one is finance, money. How much is it going to cost, and do we have in mind a funding source? Because I believe that we are not going to have lots of extra money in the near future. And so finding that is another consideration that we have to do. We can, in fact, put concepts together if it makes some sense. I guess we could do it if it made no sense. But I think it would be better if it made some sense. And then so we could put some of them together. We really have three concepts that we've looked at and heard from, and we do have people from all of those people here if anybody wants to ask any other questions of that. So we've got the OSARC issue, which will have some financial. It's much less than it was originally because we've taken out the whole section on building the website. So we're talking...
That's only for a year.
That's only for a year. So any idea, estimate?
Lauren, 550. 500.
500. And so we're, and there are economic development monies in the lottery and others. There is actually some funding there that's available, so it's something to look at. The issue with respect to Poplar has is truly a policy issue, because it's really giving to the Department of Forestry the option of coming up with the plan to do that. So it's us saying we think this is something we need to look at, and we're going to give the authorization and the authority to the Department of Forestry to make that. So it is one of those. We do know that there are poplar plantations out there that are right now at their 12 years, so it obviously meets the timeliness. If they're going to cut that all down and use it now, or are they going to continue to let it grow because they have the ability to do that? So it's definitely a timely one. And then the third issue had to do with the lot line adjustments, and in that one, in having talked to people, there is a real concern about the city's not wanting to be involved at this time. They would like it to be strictly a bill that has to do with outside of the bill, and that has not necessarily been addressed at this point with the drafts we have in front of us, but it's something that we can look at. So those are the three issues, and I guess what I'd love to hear is any process that we want to work on here on moving forward in some rational way with our group to decide where we want to go. And then I guess the final one is that we have been given kind of instructions that we pick whatever ours is, and then we can send letters to Ways and Means, we can send letters to the Speaker's office and ask them, tell them that we believe that these have real merit and we would like them to be considered in other ways. But there's no assurance that those will be. The only assurance is the bill that comes out of here does come forward in the session. So with that, Representative Bofitz.
Mr. Chair, I've spoken to my colleagues on the Republican side who are not here, and for the record, Representative Minnis, as you know, did call and has a family medical emergency and was unable to meet today. And in discussions with them, if you'll recall, just to recap what you said, during the previous session, we took action and looked at the rural county lot line issue, and it really was focused on a rural county lot line issue involving farmers, agriculture-related property. Cities kind of got in, cities kind of got out, incorporated, not by their own fruition. It just kind of happened. And so whatever we do in that line, we need to, you know, at least initially protect the cities and exempt them and focus on what this committee is really involved in, and that's, you know, agricultural forestry type issues. And that's an issue that the committee did work on. To the graciousness of the chair, you allowed us to bring it back up again. We kind of indicated we'd address it. The second issue was that we have before us is that of the hybrid poplars. I personally don't like the solution, but this committee did, in fact, say, you know, hey, you guys need to get together and we'll address this again. So we've kind of given our word a little bit on that one also. The third issue that's before us, you know, is actually an issue that we've heard before in this committee where we haven't heard the exact details of the draft proposals out there, and we're kind of bound a little bit to do something. So in discussing with my colleagues on the Republican side, we're kind of looking at this and saying, okay, these are all agriculture and forestry related issues. If we're restricted to one bill, and it's a case where the committee can come back to this, you know, in our committee process. If we only have one bill and we have 4 weeks, I'm not sure what we're all going to do. But if we have one bill, we can go back and say later, okay, we don't like the way they did that one, so we're not going to address this one if it didn't come out right. It just seems that for the sake of what we've given previously as our word and the issues out there, that we try some way to broaden a relating clause and address these issues as a whole when the committee goes forward. And of course, we have other opportunities between now and then. I don't have a solution, did not raise it with my colleagues, the issue of Ways and Means. And I think we've raised the issue that, you know, there may be e-dollars, there may be lottery dollars. I mean, I don't have a solution for the dollar amount. But I think even in worst case, if we don't take the policy position of saying we need to get sustainable and we need to get this done now, even if we don't have a funding mechanism for it, it seems like we need to address it. I'm not a big gambler, since I gamble with my life in the government all the time. And so sending a letter, I don't see any precedence that the Speaker has issued a letter saying you can do two or three extra bills. I've heard rumors from senior leadership, not on my side, but on the opposing side or on the cooperating side, that says the Senate individual bills may not be heard in the House. And I'm not quite sure how the e-board and the finance thing is going to work together. So our philosophy from our side would be try to combine them into a relating clause to agriculture and forestry and adding and creating, and then address it as we go forward as a committee as a whole. And if the consensus comes up that we can't fund it or we don't have a solution, we can amend that out. Or if the counties decide that they want to have a food fight over the lot line, we amend that out. But to me, the committee's done a whole lot of work over the last session and a whole lot of work to this date, and we're kind of restrictive, yet they all relate to agriculture and forestry, and they're all things that various members of this committee kind of gave their word that we would address. And so we have kind of a break between our word and our honor and what is capable unless we take a little broader approach.
Mr. Chair, I need a little refresher on a couple of these issues. The hybrid poplar issue, recalling what we had back in the regular session, was a proposal to take hybrid poplars out of the Forest Practices Act. Wasn't it? It was a fairly broad bill. And how does this compare to that?
And I guess we could have, would somebody like to come forward? Because I think it's best to get it directly. Because this is a creative solution to that. Because it does not take it out of the Northwest Practices Act.
Okay. Actually puts it in.
It was never in it. It was never in it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Peden, representing Greenwood Resources, the folks who own the 30,000-acre hybrid poplar farm out in Boardman and another 7,000 acres in the Columbia County area. You're right. The original bill from last session was to basically extend the exemption for hybrid poplar out of the Forest Practices Act as it's currently written. The exemption is for trees or hybrid poplar trees grown up to 12 years. The original bill, I believe, if I remember correctly, was asking for a 20-year rotation cycle. Okay. That bill didn't pass. Since the end of last session, with certainly from some direction and advice from members of this committee, we've met with folks who had concerns about that bill last session, primarily Oregon Forest Industry Council, Farm Bureau, Small Woodlands Association. We've met with them many times over the last several months and had some very good conversations. The bill that we presented to your interim committee last time you met, roughly a month ago, was a compromise bill that each one of those organizations plus my client was comfortable in moving forward. And what that does is, I don't have the language in front of me, so the broadest sense was takes the decision-making authority essentially out of the regarding hybrid poplar out of the legislative hand and takes it down to the Board of Forestry and asks them to make an administrative rulemaking on the appropriate regulatory entity for hybrid poplar. There are a couple of different things and specifics in that bill that ask them to consider, but it is a broad piece of language, I think, that allows them to define the regulation. Obviously, what my client's looking for is still some ability to extend the rotation cycle, and that is what Representative Roblin referred to earlier, that we are for a good chunk of our trees right now. We're in the 12th year and coming up on the 13th year, so there is a timeliness to making a decision here one way or the other. I think I'll leave it at that for the moment if there's any more questions.
And so, in fact, the bill would not address the taxing structure, which would change. There would be tax implications if they go into the forestry business as opposed to the farm business, and that they have to look at that in their business model and all those kinds of things. It doesn't address that. But it does give the forestry department and the commission the idea that is it wise to leave trees on the ground? Is it wise to leave standing trees in so many acres? The size of the clear cut, basically, because they're going to cut all of it down and regrow it. All of those things, which are part of the Forestry Act, would be looked at on a case-by-case basis as they make their proposal.
So those trees that are grown currently are completely exempt from the Act on a 12-year rotation cycle, they would be, going to Representative Boquist's point, they would be brought under the Act, but subject to the opportunity to regulate in a way that would be regulate them differently and maybe less onerously than being full bore subject.
Yes.
The first 12 years still stays the status quo, right?
Correct. If they harvest in the first 12 years, it's an agricultural product.
Exempt. And then anything from 13 to 20, they make an application to the Board of Forestry that says, you know, we should be able to just essentially harvest these like a crop, because that's what they are. And the Board of Forestry would look at their particular situation and say, yes, we have a stewardship agreement we're going to enter into that you can do that, and you don't have to leave one snag out in the middle for an endangered species that probably isn't going to live, you know, in that particular plantation anyway. But
that's up to them to have that conversation.
Yeah. And the thing that I find complex, and it is not addressed here, and that is there is a totally different tax structure between forest lands and farmlands, and who receives that money is different as well. Plus there's the harvest tax, there's all of those issues. And if you change from one use to another, there's a pretty hefty bill that goes along with that use change. So if you were in farm use and you transferred to forest use, as would be in this case, there's a pretty big per acre charge that comes out that has to be paid as well. And that, those are all issues that they're going to have to work with, but it's not addressed in this issue. So it all becomes part of that. Is that kind of your understanding?
No, I think that's absolutely right. The sequence there is that under this bill, before the tax issue could be figured out, the Board of Forestry would have to make a decision on the regulatory structure. Is it ag? Is it forestry? If so, how? What's the details of that conversation? So it is likely that we would get some ruling, whatever that ruling would be, from the Board of Forestry under this bill, and then the sequence on addressing the tax issue would come second.
Okay. Further questions? But a unique solution in the sense that the two groups that were at odds during the session came together and said, is this something we live with? And both agreed to that one. And from that point, I have heard nothing from either side disagreeing with that. They seem to all be on the line with that possibility.
I'm sure they don't like me whining about it either.
Either side.
Either side. That's two.
And then the lot line adjustments. I'm
there was a LUBA decision before last session, but not too much before, fairly close.
It was during the last session,
which basically said that what we have been doing for the previous 30 years with respect to simple lot line adjustments on property did not meet the test, and you have to go back and do a number of other things before you can do that lot line adjustment. So we worked on, actually Representative Boquist worked with a couple of those, and it was very into the session, so it moved from one committee to another. And finally, because at the time Representative Boquist had given his word that until there was an agreement with all parties, we aren't going to move it forward, and at the end some things broke down, so he removed it with the understanding that we would at least consider it for this 08 session. Or at least that was my commitment to him. And it came back. We still have some issues with respect to cities, but the bottom line, the concerns that happen out there is that there are people who have used that at times to adjust one piece of property that's non-compliant to make one compliant and another non-compliant, so whether it's a house or whatever. I mean, it did some different kinds of issues. Yeah. And most of the time it has been simple things. Rivers change, and it was a boundary, and all of a sudden you need to do a lot line adjustment to make it whole again. And there are other times when you have two pieces that are equally large, but to sell it, the best deal to do would be to take this natural boundary and move the other boundary over to it and say, here's two complying groups that now have a lot line adjustment that makes it easier. There have been cases, especially in that land, where you've got two different assayers have come by over many years, and there's several lines.
And your house is in the middle of one of them.
So it's kind of like, how do we make one of those right, the right line? So it's all of those kinds of things that happen out there that counties, for the most part, have been able to deal with pretty easily in the past. They basically just said, this is the new lot line. And now it's there are environmental studies. There's a whole bunch of things that have to be done before you can do that. So it's changed the whole complexity of that issue. Cities have a totally different issue. They have their own regulations and rules and a whole bunch of other kinds of things that they have to do, and they don't and they have specific rules against things like making non-compliant uses and non-compliant sizes and so on and so forth. So they're not sure that they need this or want to be a part of it, so that's an ongoing issue. And so what we have is we're not quite where we need to be. I think what Representative Boquist has said is true, that maybe there are some things that we can just say in farm or forest land only. That's the only place it covers, nothing else. So that would take it out of the city realm. But it's something we would have to work on between now and again with the people who are writing it.
On this House Bill 3549 from last session, on the back there were some amendments here. Were these envisioned to also be folded into what we'd be doing?
Yes, because they were the ones that he was just trying to get.
Sure, Representative Hume, yes, and the restricting, and again, what we're focusing on is trying to solve the rural county issue. And of course, and so anything that we go forward, you know, to legislative council needs to encompass that with a guidance from the committee to focus on the rural county issue and exempting and protecting the cities. And then at a later point when we get in between now and then, we get into, it doesn't look like it's going to work, we amend it out. Likewise, the only thing, the only steadfast one I've seen is the poplar and the forest owners are all still smiling with the same face. And so that one doesn't look like it's going to change. But I think even then, if you go to the other issue, which is the sustainable forest, I mean, we could be told 60 days from now that, you know, you can't do the money portion or you can do the money portion.
And I think I've come to the opinion that part of our problem with OSARC last time is it was just a bill Ways and Means. And we really need to have the policy behind it. And that's why the policy part, even if we don't get the money, I think is still important. So I think there's still the discussion. But I agree, it's not totally fleshed out. I have had comments from people saying, you know, maybe the makeup of the board is not exactly right. I mean, there's some things that we can work on between now and the session to get those things fleshed out. We have time to do that if we put it. So the question is, I guess the first question is, do we want to put all three of them together and come up with Oregon's version of the Farm Bill?
Or
I hate to say that as it's going right now.
Or
do we want to cut somebody out of this? Axe somebody off the
deal. Well,
so.
Mr. Chair, if others believe that all three ideas ought to move forward, I would certainly support that. Of the three, I'd say I don't understand the lot line adjustment issues well enough to be able to say what I think the right answer is there. And that it would just take a little more spade work. On the other two, I think that the broad policy statement we would be making about OSARC, I think, is an important policy statement to make and to move it forward. And the hybrid poplar proposal is, I think, rewarding the work that has been done to achieve consensus between groups that were not together before is an important thing to do as well. So I would like to see at least those two go forward, and I could go yay or nay on whether lot lines are included.
Mr. Chair, from our perspective on the other side, since I'm the only one, I think there's been concerns raised that if the relating clause is too wide, something might, you know, go awry or something. And I think the speakers pointed out that, you know, we're all working on consensus here. And I think individually and as a collective whole, the three bills have all had input and work from multiple members on both sides to try and address issues that we claimed we were going to address. And, you know, and if it turns out that 3549 is not the solution, you know, then I will go with a good counselor and say, well, it's not done yet when it comes to time. But having said that, I would like to move that we move all three bills to legislative council to have them drafted with, of course, the popular as-is, with the old version of 3549 protecting and holding harmless the cities, and that the Oregon Sustainable go forward and come back in a form that may be able to be sent to Ways and Means if it's necessary, or we can amend it out later, which would then give us the options that we have later on. And that would give us all committee members a chance then to vet this between now and then.
Just one question. Yes. Is procedural. does legislative council have the option to say to us, no, you can't have we can't think of a relating clause broad enough for all three of those?
I have one. For the record, Mr. Chair. Relating to agriculture and forestry, amending and creating new provisions, which I think encompasses all of those. So I have faith in legislative council in exchange for not complaining further about not being able to draft bills.
I'm willing to go with that, you know, obviously reserving the right later to amend something in or out. I think Greg said exactly what I felt, which is I haven't studied the lot line adjustment to know, and I would have thought the relating clause on that would have been something with land use or zoning or something. But if we can get them to take it and put them all in, we can always amend them back out later if need be.
It's the hardest one to fit with the other two, that's for sure. From my perspective, I personally would like to see this. I worked on all three of these. I have felt, you know, we didn't understand the rules coming into this today, what we were going to be expected to do. If we can get a bill that can do these kinds of things, I don't know how that... I give a lot of credence to our wonderful people over in Legislative Council to see if they can do this. But it does move forward the issues that I think are important, and which we have a pretty good bipartisan agreement on to keep working towards. And I am of the opinion as well that if we come together in January and look at this and the groups aren't together, then those people are, that's going to fall off.
Right.
And so as long as we have that agreement. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is I feel pretty comfortable, even though it'll be a fairly broad relating clause, and the people that I've talked to, that as long as we're working with each other to move forward stuff that's bipartisan and we aren't trying to force stuff, that we aren't going to have any playing around with that. And I feel pretty comfortable with that. So.
And Mr. Chair, I have like a 200-word motion on the circular.
Yes.
Whatever
yes.
I said.
So we
did
have a motion.
Okay.
I might as well take a vote on the motion because I don't see any other discussion.
Restate the motion was to combine all three under a single relating clause that would be sufficiently broad and move them forward to drafting. Okay. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Any other, yes?
With the restriction on the two caveats, one was to inclusive of dollar amounts so that we might amend them out for the Oregon Sustainable mm-hmm. Resource so that we as a committee could vet that even if we didn't send it forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was focusing the lot line purely on the rural county farm forest issue and holding the cities harmless.
Okay.
Because if we can take the money out, we can get the policy through, and we can still go after ways and means to put the money in.
Mm-hmm.
And that would allow us to pass our bill without the money. And that is a reasonable expectation.
Okay.
My understanding is now we probably aren't going to have subcommittees of ways and means. So
doesn't look like it.
I'm not going to be our cross-pollinator and carry the day in natural resources because there won't be one.
Yeah. Okay. I guess any further discussion? Then we might as well take a roll call vote on the motion. Excused. Excused.
Hi.
Excused.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Motion passes. And is there any other discussion business to come before the committee right now? We are going to adjourn and then come open again.
Yeah, come back at one.
Okay.
Recess.
And that's the captain animal, right?
Correct. So this afternoon we'll have an informational meeting with testimony that we've invited testimony. So people are welcome to come back. So we will adjourn the morning meeting and we will be reconvening at about 1:00. At about 1:05. So with that, I will invite Roy, come on up, and whoever else you want to bring.
Thanks, Representative. Chair Roland and staff, appreciate the opportunity here today. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Captain Walt Marquis, Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. On his right, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Again, thanks for the opportunity, Representative, to come forward and lay out some perspective on Oregon law and policy regarding captive wildlife and the public. And we have some testimony we prepared, sir, which we'll go through, a number of attachments regarding revised statutes and some other attachments which are self-explanatory. Anyway, appreciate the opportunity. Again, what we want to do is provide an overview of state law and policies regarding the capture and holding of native wildlife and a bit of perspective on the case of the Malala black-tailed deer. As you know, sir, the legislature provides statutory direction to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, which has passed rules regarding the public's holding and capture of wildlife. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and OSP Fish and Wildlife Division are the state agencies that enforce these wildlife laws and policies and protect both the public and the state's wildlife in accord with Oregon State wildlife policy. Like most states, in this state, Chair Roblin, wildlife belongs to the public. And there's a state agency, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, that is responsible for that relationship with wildlife and the public. This wasn't always the case. Prior to statehood, folks used wildlife, took wildlife when they wished, for whatever purposes they wished. That led to a long-term decline in wildlife in this state and in many states. And frankly, one of the most interesting issues is that even in Eastern Oregon, with its many thousands of deer and elk, in Eastern Oregon, elk were extirpated in the early 20th century and had to be reintroduced from Yellowstone National Park, and that's why we have the elk herds there today. Anyway, but besides this history lesson, and besides the issues regarding the policy reasons of the public and statehood, there's some good common sense reasons why we have statutes and rules regarding what the public can do with wildlife. First and foremost, wildlife is wild. In other words, possessing wildlife can be dangerous to your health, your animal's health, your domestic animal's health, and the public's health. We're not just talking wildlife diseases, but sometimes even physical attacks by animals that long-term have thought to be pets and otherwise. And deer are a good example of this, as you see from Attachment 2. And in particular, frankly, for all the discussion of the danger regarding cougars and bears, deer kill more people in the United States every year than cougars and bears do. So deer are an issue for the agency, along with some of the more dangerous mammals. Second of all, untrained, unlicensed individuals illegally holding Oregon's wildlife are dangerous to wildlife themselves. We're talking wildlife diseases and that could get out from the general population if wildlife's not properly cared for. In addition, what we have found many times is that wildlife tends to be held in poor conditions or facilities with little real understanding about what the animal or animals may need for optimum health and nutrition. So there are many times when we have gone in to captive wildlife situations, found them not to be in good shape, and many times, because they're in such poor shape, the animals had to be euthanized. Finally, in Oregon, there are permits available to hold such animals as deer. There's scientific taking permits for researchers. There's rehab permits for those who care for and nurse back to health animals for release in the wild. We also allow the holding certain members of the deer and elk family under what we call a cervid propagation license. And the commission, along with the department, has developed these rules, along with the cervid industry, that regulate these activities for holders of these permits. Permit holders generally are very law-abiding and compliant with rules in almost all cases. Turn over to Captain Marquis to talk about OSP issues.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Walt Marquis. I'm the captain of the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. And what I'd like to speak to you for a moment about today is that in most states, the enforcement branch of wildlife is positioned within the management branch. So if it wasn't the way it is in Oregon, be part of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. But Oregon has chosen to make it part of this Oregon State Police, such as the same as the state of Alaska. So the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division is responsible for the enforcement of fish and wildlife in Oregon and is mandated by statute to do that. This wildlife dollars come from the sale of licenses and tags and through ODFW and passed through the Oregon State Police for that purpose. We have approximately 120 officers who are strategically located throughout the state to assure compliance with those laws. And the Wildlife Division of the Oregon State Police has police powers just like any other police officer, well, state police officer in the state of Oregon. We also have a higher degree of training to specifically enforce those laws. The Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division works very closely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to purposely direct our patrols in areas that are needed to enforce those laws and to specifically the management objectives, including educating the public regarding the importance of Oregon's laws prohibiting the capture and removal of wildlife from their habitats. When the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division or the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife become aware of people holding wildlife in captivity illegally, there are several things we take a look at. One of the things, and we work together on this, one of the things we talk about is how do we become aware of the current situation? Number two is how are the individuals illegally holding the animal captive, and are they aware of the violation of state law? And number three, how long has the wildlife been in captivity, and do the captive wildlife pose a threat to your captors, neighbors, or others? Four, do we have an idea whether or not the individuals illegally holding the wildlife will voluntarily comply once they become aware of the law? Or will it we, as enforcement officers, have to get involved with the district attorney's office? And even to the point where a search warrant may be needed to enter the property. And number five, can we determine a safe course of action for the captive wildlife once in our possession? In coordination with these five issues I just brought up, the state police is, in conjunction with that, is determining four other things, whether there's criminal charges in coordination with the district attorney's office will be needed, whether we'll just cite the person for a violation, or whether we'll warn the person for the violation, or if no action is taken at all. During the last 18 months, the Fish and Wildlife Division has had 10 different instances where we've been in contact with the public regarding unlawful holding of wildlife or capture of wildlife. In most cases, our investigations showed the wildlife has moved in usually as a result of some well-intended person who just wants to do good. And in those cases, once we've contacted the person and advised them they're in violation of the law and educate them why these wildlife should be left in the wild, those people cooperate and the animals are just returned to the wild or rehabilitated. And I can give you a couple of examples of those 10 I've talked about. In March of 2006 in Lane County, we became aware of a person who was holding three baby raccoons, and they didn't have possession, didn't have a license or anything. And when we contacted the person, the raccoons were turned over to us, and no citations were issued. In May of 2006, in Clatsop County, three goslings were picked up from the Kennecum River by a teenager, and they were placed into a pen at his home. When we contacted these people, they cooperated. The small geese were returned to a rehabilitator, and a citation was actually issued in that case to the teenager's parents. And the third case I'll talk about is in Wasco County in June 2007. We became aware that a person had found a fawn, a small deer, laying in the city park there, and they took it home. And when we contacted the people, they voluntarily let us into the house, showed us the deer. It was laying between the couch and the wall on the floor in the living room. And that deer was returned to a rehabilitator, and the property owner was issued a citation in that case also. In some cases, the people do not want to cooperate for one reason or another, and that's when Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon State Police have to work very closely together, because by statute, the only person who can serve a search warrant in the state of Oregon is a police officer, and to get a search warrant, you have to file an affidavit, which has to show probable cause to believe that a crime has occurred and that evidence of that crime is located at a particular place where the police want to search. So an affidavit has to be prepared, a search warrant is then issued, and then the only person who can serve that search warrant is a police officer. And so as enforcement officers, that would be our expertise. However, once the animal is seized from the property, we rely on our partnership, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, to help us take care of those animals and transport them safely and get them into a safe environment. Because the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife doesn't have those police powers, it's important we work together in these situations. And with that, I'll turn over to Ron Anglin here.
Chair Roebling, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Once whether it's a search warrant type animal or otherwise, once we become in possession of the animal, we have three steps that we typically go through in determining what we'll do with that animal. And there can be multiple parts to each one of those, multiple decision points in each one of those steps. But the first thing is, what's overall the best thing that we need to do for Oregon's wildlife resources? And specifically to that, is the animal diseased in some way that it would represent a threat to other native wildlife when it was released? We have seen that quite frequently with raccoons in particular that will have distemper, and you would not want to take those animals and release them in another site and end up introducing distemper into a site where it's currently not existing. Secondly, what's the best thing for the captive wildlife itself? Is it releasable for back into the wild? And if it is, then what will it take to do that? Does it need to go to a wildlife rehabilitator, or is it capable of being released immediately at that point in time? And then third, if it's not suitable for release, what are the options for placing it someplace? And typically we have a fairly high standard for those types of facilities, zoos, educational facilities, somewhere that animal can be used as an educational opportunity for the public. We have a fair amount of experience in dealing with people that have illegally removed animals from the wild, and this has ranged from illegal commercial exploitation to, as mentioned earlier, well-intentioned people trying to help those animals. And as the captain stated, frequently it's people see a young animal that they want to pick up, they think it's been abandoned or it's been orphaned, and they want to take it home and look out for it and help it. And that's a noble feeling and a noble cause. But frequently what we see is, and in deer in particular, the doe, when those fawns are young, will frequently leave the fawn alone for extended periods of time. And then she'll come back to nurse that fawn during the course of the day. And that's an active response to avoid predators, because the fawn's not very good at escaping predators, and the predators will key in on the adult and wait until they see them nurse. So if the two are in close proximity a great deal of the time, then it obviously increases the chance for the predator to find that fawn. So it's not uncommon for deer in particular to leave those fawns alone for an extended period, and we frequently get people picking deer up in those kind of circumstances. And under questioning, we'll ask them, how long has it been since you've had the fawn? And if it's only been a couple hours, we will direct them to take the fawn back to that area, put it back where they found it, and hope that the fawn and the doe get hooked back up, because that gives it the best chance of survival. Deer that are held by people and other wildlife too, whether it's raccoons, squirrels, foxes, whatever, they do become habituated to people, and they can serve as a threat. And as you see in attachment 2, there are a lot of examples of wildlife that have attacked people over time. And some of them have been as pets. Some of them have been in situations where it's a park type setting where there's not a lot of harassment, and they become very used to people, and they can become very aggressive. And we deal with cases like that on a frequent basis here within the state. Unfortunately, with some of the common animals, when we do take them in, like raccoons, deer, fox, and owls, zoos and other facilities don't want them. They are very common, they're easy to come by, and usually the facilities are filled up, and it's very difficult to find places to locate those animals or to place those animals. Because of all of this, and because of, you know, most of the effort on when animals are picked up involves young animals, young of the year, we do conduct an extensive media campaign in the spring, sometimes in conjunction with partners, to inform them about leaving wild animals in the wild and not picking them up and raising them as pets. It's not a good thing to do. It really reduces their chance of survival, and it really puts a strain on our wildlife rehabilitators when we do end up with those animals that we're trying to rehabilitate so that we can turn them back into the wild.
Lastly, Chair Rowland, members of the committee, wanted to talk a little bit about activities and costs on this particular case. At one point, we had planned to talk a little more in detail about this case, but frankly, we did not expect still be in court at this point. And so since we are, we wanted to make some general issues, and we've been asked a little bit about costs, which we've laid out here. As you know, or probably you know, we've taken a very slow and deliberate approach to this particular case because of the high public interest and the facts of how this case began and laid out. And so the agency did spend a bunch of time on this case, and we have out-of-pocket costs, frankly, of about $1,200 veterinary fees and legal costs as of today of over $38,000, which, as this thing wins through the court, probably will be more in the end. Other than those costs, most of the other time has been with salaried folks, and frankly, most of the time spent on this case has been in response to the public's interest in the case or the press or media's thing. So, frankly, probably most of the time in this whole scenario has been spent by the information section, really responding to the public's great interest in the case or the media's demand for issue and facts of the case. Frankly, but those are essentially our out-of-pocket expenses to date. As both of you know, like most state natural resource agencies, we cover a huge range of issues. We have 1,200 employees and a budget of $261 million a biennium. And so there are times that we move people's time around to fit what the public would like us to do or fit the issues that are at the top of the page. And we have done so in this case. However, we have felt all along that, in view of the situation of the case, that because this whole thing evolved out of a direct result of an illegal wildlife activity and subsequent disposition of legally held and bred captive wildlife, in the end, we felt that we have no choice. The law is clear. The rules are clear. We've responded, as I think most any state agency would do, in that we have tried our best to be sensitive to the situation but follow state law and policy, and we have done just that. We are ourselves, after this case in particular, and we were thinking about this prior to this case, we have, in fact, met already with some of the nonprofit groups that spend a lot of time on this particular issue, captive wildlife and public picking them up, like Portland Audubon Society. And at this point, we probably will go forward with a joint message with some of the groups like Portland Audubon, Defenders of Wildlife, Oregon Hunters, and some of the other groups that have a very high interest on this issue. So we're already talking to them and looking at perhaps a joint media campaign next spring when a lot of this stuff occurs, people picking up baby animals. So that's one thing come out. The second thing, as we are, the commission has asked us, and I want to stress that we've worked very closely with our commission on this issue. And the chair of the commission has been at times involved in decision-making, most times not, but very much kept aware of the situation and the AG's perspective on this. And the commission has asked us to go back when we're all through this and do our own kind of internal review, perhaps with some public input about how we might approach these things and how these things can go better than this one did, as a matter of fact. So we also are intending to do that once we're all completed with this situation. I do want to stress, as Captain Markey said, that a situation like this, these things do occur. I mean, Oregon State Police directly involved in 10 over the last 18 months. Frankly, there's a number of them that Oregon State Police probably not involved in, just as a result of a phone call or something else. One of our local biologists goes out, talks to people, picked up captive wildlife, picked up a young animal, get it either turned over to us or releasing it back in the wild where it came from. So this captive wildlife issue and the public's relationship with it is not an uncommon one for the agency. We spend a lot of time on it every year between our media messages, between our local field contacts and otherwise. This one, much more than any other one I can remember. We've had some like this in the past. You might remember from down your area, Representative Roblin, we had Windfall the Bear. And the people like to take a shower with Windfall, and there's a long relationship with Windfall, and Windfall is now down at a zoo in California. So these things evolve. It's pretty uncommon for these things to kind of end up where this one has ended up with the amount of time and action called for. But nonetheless, it's a situation that's well-defined in law and rule, and so we have tried to act sensibly but accordingly with our mandates as a state agency. And with that, I end our testimony and entertain any questions. Thank you very much.
I do have a couple of questions. I wasn't aware of this particular issue, but they're general in nature.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Captain Mark, you refresh my memory, and I'm not talking about any specific case, but as a historical perspective, you mentioned, you know, when you go to either a biologist, Roy, or a fish and wildlife guy goes out, or, you know, a game warden goes out. I mean, kind of the steps in the legal process in Oregon is you go out and figure out what are they doing? Did they commit a crime? Did they know they were, you know, not supposed to do this, or were they good intentioned? And that's kind of the first step there, because this is the way the law really works: is, you know, to commit the crime, the guy had to know they were committing a crime and intended to commit a crime for the most part. And in many of these cases, they're resolved by going out and saying, hey, you know, did you know the law was this? And, you know, they found something somewhere that was injured or something along that line. And for better word, I guess what I'm driving at, instead of being as your dual-hatted, you know, basically fish and wildlife and the state police or the game wardens are kind of dual-hatted in this state, is it a case of going out and explaining the law and working down through that? Or is it simply a case of a regulatory type agency where you go out and it's cut and dried? You know, you walk in the door, and, you know, I don't know, there's a bear there, and obviously they're guilty because the bear is on the premise, and so therefore, you know, we go down that line. Because I know you talked a little bit about the testimony, but the legal aspects of that, because this is much more complex, because you're referencing the AG, you see, which is funny, but it's actually a district attorney's office that prosecutes, and that's a different pot of gold, so to speak, and we can't even get them to prosecute meth dealers these days. So,
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Broquist, I'll try to answer that for you. Typically, we are dual-hatted. Normally, when you get a call of someone holding wildlife in captivity, we probably wouldn't even contact Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to start with. We'd just go there, attempt to knock on the door and talk to the people, just like we're talking now,
right,
and try to explain the law. And if that's the course of action and it continues down that road, as it typically does, it's very easy. We explain the law, educate the person why they can't be doing this, and why it's important that they comply with the law. And in most cases, they do comply with the law, and the animal would either be removed, or we would, if we needed the expertise from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to remove the animal, we would then bring them into the picture. Mm-hmm. Now, when a person says, get off my property, you're trespassing, I don't want you on here, a state police officer is trespassing just like anybody else, we're required to leave the property. So we would leave the property. Mm-hmm. Now, if we had evidence that there's a crime there, maybe while we were there we seen the animal, or we had an informant that told us that the animal was there, or any probable cause to believe that there's wildlife being held there in captivity, our only recourse at that time is to get a search warrant and to go back to under the search warrant. But to get a search warrant, we have to prepare an affidavit, and in the affidavit it requires that we show probable cause to believe that there's a crime that has been committed. We outline what the crime is. We outline what the evidence of that crime is at this place or location we want to go to. And then once a magistrate has to sign the search warrant. And once the search warrant is signed, we are commanded, required to go and seize that evidence. And we have 5 working days to make return to the court what we located from that location. And so that's the recourse we have once there's no cooperation and we're told to leave. And so under that situation, of course, you're concerned about officer safety. You're concerned about the safety of our partners who are not armed or trained in situations like that. So we would take precautions to make a plan on how we're going to do this. We would talk about how we're going to enter the property, secure whatever threats there are, either there or that may show up after you get there. And then, of course, how we're going to remove that wildlife safely and transport it safely and where it's going to go at that point. So it becomes very complex. It becomes search and seizure laws come into play, trespass laws come into play, and the safety of the officers and those that they need or are required to serve that search warrant. Did I answer your question?
Follow-up question, sure. Roy, from a policy perspective, again, I'm not talking about any specific case, but, you know, what pops to mind, and I don't remember what it was the case way over in Eastern Oregon or something along that line. But from a policy perspective, is there a program at Fish and Wildlife, like at Justice and elsewhere, where do you reimburse a district attorney for his costs, or is it, you know, you just provide evidence? I mean, how's that costing model? Or is there a costing model? Because I know there,
and the captain might know this, there are certain crimes that if you commit in a county, you know, many of them related to domestic abuse and stuff, that for a better word, don't like the term, but a bounty, that says, you know, if the DA prosecutes this crime, that, you know, we'll reimburse him X amount of that cost. Is there any such a program for wildlife at all?
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Brokwist, there is no set amount. There are crimes. All fish and wildlife crimes in the state of Oregon are considered Class A misdemeanors.
Okay.
And so under a Class A misdemeanor means you could go to jail up to a year, no more than a year, and that you could be fined up to $6,050. But that is not what goes to the district attorney.
Right.
The district attorney's office has its own budget, its own priorities, and, you know, you got 36 counties in the state of Oregon, and I can tell you that Multnomah County treats its wildlife offenses differently than Baker County does. Or any other county, but there's no reimbursement back to the district attorney's offices for those.
Okay.
And I can give you an example of a large investigation I was involved with, and in fact it was Baker County, where they have a small budget. Mm-hmm. The district attorney has a small budget, one person on staff, and we investigated probably 15 people that were New Jersey, New York, mm-hmm. Florida, all over the country. They needed to come back for trial, and it was the prosecutor couldn't afford to prosecute those people, so plea bargains were negotiated. But that money is absorbed through their budget.
Okay, great.
Other questions?
No.
Okay. And I guess mine, and I see a little bit in the testimony, we have not done a lot of training in our state over the last number of years with respect to telling the public to, you know, watch out for these animals. Every once in a while, there'll be an issue when we get an alert in a particular area that there's some distemper or something going through a population of mice and whatever. Stay away if you see one that's dead, just report it and all that kind of stuff. But as a kid growing up in another rural area and being in a community where there was a lot of hunting and stuff, I was taught very early, you know, when the bird falls out of the tree, it was learning how to fly. Your job is not to pick it up and help it, because mom doesn't go back to the one that you were touching. And on the coast, when they passed a whole bunch of laws, we had a lot of outreach to let people know that marine mammals, you know, their mother leaves the little seal on the beach, and if you go pick it up, or even if you have your dog attacks it, you're in real trouble. I mean, it's pretty well posted. We know clearly that if you start playing around with marine mammals right now and take them home, you're in trouble at the federal level, not only the state level. And some it's true with some of the migratory marine birds, same issue. And so, you know, you have to be careful. Even when there's an oil spill and you want to go pick up the birds and do it, you better be doing it with the right people. And so we get those. I don't know that, do we have a discussion about those kinds of things in the department with regard to ongoing?
Well, Representative Roblin, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, we are having an ongoing discussion about how we can become more effective on that. I think, frankly, the seal pup campaign, because the seal pups are in very certain areas,
right,
and because those areas are easily defined, because it's the beach, because it's the coast, and with all the signing and things we've done, I would say the seal pup issue is our best education, our best education effort, because of the way it's geographically defined. So now, do people still bring an occasional seal pup into the Newport office? Yes, they do.
Yeah, they do.
Yes, they do. But there's a whole lot of people, too, that see a seal pup and make a call to our Newport office and go, there's a seal pup out here. And we go, yeah, great, that's the 35th phone call we got on seal pup. By the way, let it alone. And people let it alone. So we've done a pretty good job there. When you get away from the coast on these more general issues, we could do a better job, and that's one of the reasons we have already sat down with, you know, Portland Audubon. Most folks don't realize it, but they literally see thousands of small animals a year because they are a major rehab facility in the Portland area. And people, not just the hawks and owls and what you commonly think of, but people bring in all kinds of young wildlife every year in spite of everybody's best effort. And that's the first place we went to sit down and talk to Bob Salinger, who runs the rehab center, and said, Bob, how can we be more effective to get the message out, particularly in the metropolitan area, as more and more people are less and less familiar with how the world works for wildlife in the wild? How do we do that? And so we've already talked about partnering with the media on messages to push that. So that's an ongoing discussion, Chair Roblin, and I think you will see a more intense campaign in the future on that issue. Because, like I said, 95%+ of all these issues where we have to go talk to someone and they have captive wildlife they've picked up, they're trying to do the right thing. They're nice people. They're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to help the animal, and they're not realizing they're breaking state law. And we go talk to them, or Walt's folks go talk to them, and they go, "Gee, we're really sorry. How do we kind of get it? You know, how do we? Will you take this and put it back, or whatever?" And that's where it ends up. But there are a few that don't go that way. Sometimes you have to be high visibility, like this one, or the bear issue, or the cougar issue in Eastern Oregon every few years, or something like that. And so I think you're going to see a renewed emphasis, frankly, from the department again on this issue, because the better we can educate the public, the better ahead we're going to be, and the less cases like this we're going to have.
Sure, I do have a question. Roy, and talking overall here, I think the good captain made mention of 10 cases or something like that. And you know, I've had a similar discussion along this in one of these events over in Eastern Park. The number of cases where you've brought in charges last year, 2 years, 5 years, from a policy perspective back to us, I mean, how many of those have been successful prosecution? How many has the court decided that, nope, bad idea, you shouldn't have done it? I mean, what's the, generally speaking, like Captain mentioned, 10 cases in the last year or 2 years?
Well, 10 instances when we ended up contacting people who had captive wildlife. I couldn't tell you how many of these cases actually went forward with citations and what happened to those. Representative Boquist, be happy to follow up that information. My sense a lot of the time is kind of what essentially my sense is the Clackamas County DA's office, kind of, you know, in the end, laws being violated, but in the end, the state's property was hopefully returned to the state, and so the issue's been dealt with. Is there anything more to be gained by going ahead on a criminal citation, a criminal kind of misdemeanor or violation? I think most DAs with their workload today probably go, you know, if this thing has ended up in the right situation, there's no need for me to press forward on charges now on these folks. And I think that's where most of the district attorneys kind of fall on this. It just depends, too. If there's somebody that, for whatever reason, maybe that has been cooperative, that's sometimes part of the mix or whatever. But I think Walt said best, there's 36 counties. Each district attorney looks at its resources and exactly what the facts of the case were and try and figure out what's to be gained if they go ahead in a court kind of criminal case. I'm sorry, Walt, you want to
go ahead? Chair Robin, Vice Chair Boquist. As an agency, as Oregon State Police, maybe I'll more directly answer part of your question here. We look at the level of enforcement necessary to get compliance, the lowest level possible. If a warning will suffice to get compliance, that's what we do. If it takes a citation, that's what we do. And I suppose even maybe not in holding wildlife. I can't ever recall taking someone to jail for holding wildlife, but that's an option also because they are Class A misdemeanors. Now, typically when it gets to district attorney, they also have the opportunity to look at the situation, talk to the people, and oftentimes if it was cited as a crime, and there's some state law here, if the crime was committed and it wasn't in the officer's presence, it has to be cited as a crime. We can't cite it as a violation. So if there was a situation that wasn't in the officer's presence, it would have to be cited as a crime. But always the district attorney had the opportunity to lower the crime to a violation, which just shows there's no culpable mental state or just a violation be similar to a traffic ticket. And I think in most of these cases, that's what happens with the district attorney's offices is cases like these are, if they are prosecuted, they're lowered to a violation. The level of proof is less. It doesn't necessarily go on the person's record like a crime would, and especially if they're cooperating.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And I think from the legislative perspective, you know, what we're looking at is policy. And the terms is, and Roy and I've had this discussion before, sometimes you look at it, the law, and say from a policy perspective, if you look and say if we took 50 cases to court and we only 20 of them ever succeeded in prosecution, then you step back and look and see, you know, are we doing the right thing? Is the judge, you know, and you look when you do your review at the commission level, Roy, you look at that and say, is this a good policy and are we approaching this in the right direction? Or is it a waste of taxpayer dollars? Or is it a case where we need to do more education, as you pointed out? And then you kind of do an overall review. I just want to make sure that when you do that review, you look back and say, you know, if we're batting zero for 15 and the judge said 15 times that, you know, it's screwed up, you shouldn't have done what you did, or I don't see it there, then from a policy perspective, we need to go back and look at it and say, state police has to do what they have to do, but maybe we should come back to us and say, look, we need to do some tweaking in the law, and we're facing this with this whole totally unrelated issue of 500 species that we can't categorize where they fit. But that sort of thing there. And I would ask that when, and I don't need to see the numbers, but when you do that review, you look at that perspective and say, is there something on the criminal side we need to address so that the state police don't have to go out and do X, Y, Z 50 times because the judge throws it out 50 times, or the DA won't prosecute it. I guess it's the old adage where, you know, we should take two laws off the books for everyone we pass, but there's not much I can do about that.
Just a follow-up, Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist. I have at least one legislator has called and asked me, do I believe that the department probably should pursue some type of civil authority, which we don't have currently, on issues like this, and I don't know the ramifications of that yet, Representative Boquist. I told them that I would be looking into that issue, because maybe it doesn't need to be a criminal charge in the end. Maybe if we had civil authority, that might be something for the department to consider having a discussion with the commission about. But as you said, that's all part of the mix in taking a hard look of how these things end up and why. And so I told this one particular senator that I would be looking at that issue, and we came back to him prior to the 09 session to see if that's an option that we should seriously look at.
Thank you.
Thank you. So is there anything else that you want to share with us about this individual case or whatever? I know it's an ongoing case, so there's not a lot, and so I can give you a little time to, if you want to wrap up or... That's all you need.
Representative Roblin, again, the agency appreciates the opportunity, and the commission appreciates the opportunity for the agency to come forward and talk a little bit about the statutes, the rules, and the policies regarding this issue of captive wildlife in the public. And like I said, this is not the first case that there's been a lot of issues on public interest in. It won't be the last case that this happens to. Hopefully they're far and few between. But it's a difficult issue. Clearly laid out in statute and rule, but again, I guess our point is that the agency, the New York State Police, we try and be sensitive to the public. We know in many situations the public thinks you're doing the right thing. We're sensitive to that, and the DA is also probably sensitive. That's why Representative Boquist, you don't see as many go forward to trial or in a criminal way. But it is a serious issue and one that we're going to continue to work on from the AG perspective, particularly on the education side and on other ways to get our message across about the real issues and dangers in public health, safety, and welfare on these captive wildlife issues. And so we're going to continue to work on this, to work with our partners on this, and do the best we can to continue on this issue. I appreciate the time just to come before your committee, sir, and lay this out as where we're at on this.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, too. And we will continue to check with you as this case goes on and possibly have another opportunity to look at it. And I think one of the things that we oftentimes forget is we have a lot of wildlife, and there are a lot of disease. There's a lot of other problems that go along with wildlife. And, you know, the little attachments you gave here about the people being killed by a deer and others, we don't even think about some of those things because we have been... we've watched as we grow up our cartoons and our wildlife stories and other kinds of things, and so we have an impression of some of our wildlife that is not necessarily the same impression that exists in the wild. And I keep going back to our parents. Oftentimes, you know, you go out and visit, look, it's kind of great, but you know, don't intermix too much because you never know what you're going to get. And it's a great time to get out there and visit our natural resources, but you know, leave it better than when you went, and do all the kinds of things that we were all taught as kids to do is a good adage, and that means you leave the stuff that's there. You know, every kid wants to take a sea star off the ocean floor or whatever with them, and then all they get when they get home is a lot of smell. And they can't realize, you know, they can't take care of it. They catch the little fish in the container, and they take it home, and they can't figure out why the little fish dies a short period of time after they get home because, you know, there's no oxygen left in the water. I mean, there's just a whole lot of stuff. And so go visit and watch and leave the stuff. And I guess that's kind of what we're saying here. And I do appreciate the time that you've had. So any further? So thank you for your time. And we did have, it's really invited testimony only, and the only one was this, right? But we do have a fellow legislator here who has asked, and if you'd like to come forward, Vic, we would love to give you the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair and staff. For the record, I'm Vic Gilliam, State Representative District 18, home to the killer deer, Bucky and Snowball. This has have had so much attention that I am very pleased that you would take the time to do this. I am particularly taken by your reminder and taking the opportunity here to, wherever we can, when there's a microphone going and a camera going, to remind people, and I agree with you, that capturing wildlife is very serious, and there are public safety issues, and we should leave our wildlife and our resources better than we found them. It's precisely what I think is the good out of the bad of the situation, and I think to a certain extent the department and others have taken the opportunity of media attention to make that message, and I hope we continue to do that. I have a couple of observations I wanted to share because this was in my district, and I felt, at least as an involved observer, if not involved in the process. As far as policy goes, the overall issues, I have a lot to learn, and so I was interested in the testimony, and I'll be interested in as this unfolds. But I wanted to say that, in my view, we do need to look at this policy and either tweak it, as the Vice Chair suggested, or actually look at some other legislation, because I think there were some triggers in this case that led us down a road that was extremely expensive and overdone. There's no question that there was a law violated. And yet you have to look at that in the context of a larger situation. You alluded to how many species do we have. We are coming in contact with deer all the time. I have, as Oregon grows, we're going to be in increasing contact with deer and other wildlife. I have a deer family living under my deck. I didn't invite them. If Fish and Wildlife comes out, I would completely comply with whatever they suggested. But we are in contact with deer more and more. So in the context, you know, I think of the example, some of us may or may not have violated the law in speeding to get here to the Capitol today. But can we, certainly not the Vice Chair, but can we prosecute all those? I don't think so. So in the context of this, how far can we go on each individual situation? So my point of view has been, let's come back to some point of realism and common sense, because we can't put Fish and Wildlife through this on every situation. There are a number of questions I've had for the department over the last few weeks, and we don't need to get into those today, but I will say this. I completely agree with the director when he says they were very slow and deliberate. I'm sure there was a reason for that. And I think I agree with him when he says he wants this other cases to go better than this one did. So do I. But I also would caution anyone, whether it's the director or any of us, always expect to be in court longer than you think you're going to be in court. So I'm not surprised that we're still tied up. We can't comment. It's inappropriate for legislators to get involved in that case. But my whole point in this, as a representative of a constituent who had a concern about their what they believe to be a pet deer, was that we could get a communication going. And to the extent that the policy can reflect that or encourage that, I don't know if we have to encourage conflict resolution training or what, but in this particular case, my opinion, my observation would have been, despite the fact that my constituent got a lawyer, we still were in play in terms of a discussion. That discussion never took place. I was very disappointed in the executive department and the governor's office specifically and their unwillingness to call a meeting to talk. I think that our state government ought to talk to people about this before we lawyer up. So, yes, they had a lawyer, but we weren't in court yet. So when we look at policy, let's look at ways that we can better communicate before we get off to the races and we force Fish and Wildlife into a situation where they need to be defensive, where they need to spend $38,000 of taxpayers' dollars on a single deer through the Department of Justice, I assume. And let's talk, and perhaps we could work this out. Again, my opinion. I believe that this could have been worked out. I believe that perhaps they needed to be cited. Perhaps that could have been suspended in some way. And I believe that they were trainable and could have become appropriate servid licensed. Again, that's not my experience, but nobody talked about it. And I believe that in this case, the private citizens were willing to do that. And we didn't take that opportunity. And if we need, as legislators, to provide that opportunity or encourage that opportunity in policy, then I think we should, and I would encourage the committee to look at that as you continue. Lastly, I would say that I just feel that a lot of well-intentioned people allowed a very isolated, easily resolved situation to get out of hand. And I believe that we ought to be looking at ways that we can pull that back a little, resolve these issues more quickly. I would also parenthetically say I was very pleased with the decision to place this deer, and the deer is still in state custody, at another facility in Malala. Also, obviously, another constituent of mine that's already pre-approved. But I am not pleased how long it took us to get to that option, and yet we still have not returned the deer. So I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about this on my first time back in the building after this story broke at the Consumer Protection Committee. One of our colleagues had put a Beanie Baby deer with a thank you note from Bucky and Snowball on my chair. But it's not a laughing matter, and I just want to end the way I started, echoing you, Mr. Chair. As humorous as this may or may not have become, there are safety issues, and let's use this issue to inform the public that we ought not to be taking deer into our possession and that there are consequences. But let's also use common sense when it comes to the case of just one deer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any discussion?
Again, I do want to thank people for being here. You know, I think we put situations occur and we react, and I agree with you, and well-intentioned people trying to get to solutions are the most important thing that our state government can do. We have expectations of our departments to take care of different kinds of things. We have really great people working for them, and still situations arise. And I would hope, you know, we talked about a lot in the agriculture last session about getting some new, and we passed a couple of bills that allowed for young people to go out and hunt with their family. We did some other kinds of things, which I think are a real positive towards getting people engaged back in that wilderness and to understand these issues and to recognize when they get out there the problems that can happen with wildlife being thought of as pets and other things, and as opposed to the wildlife that they are. And hopefully we'll get more people engaged in these conversations, and we'll keep having the education go on so that people know, you know, that just because an animal looks like it's unattended and whatever doesn't mean that it is. That might have been its best defense, and other kinds of things that many people knew all along when they were growing up, which we've gotten away from. And so we'll have fewer and fewer of these kinds of problems where people... it's fun to have the deer in your neighborhood. We have an elk herd that come down and visit and eats my wife's roses every time they start growing when we have deer in our neighborhood as well. So we recognize they're there. It's really beautiful to see these animals, but they need to be kept in the context of wild animals that they are. And to train your kids to not go out and think you should go pet every wild animal, because that's not a really good thing to do, and it's the bear. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that when we haven't had the opportunity to be out in the wilderness and to recognize what it's like out there. So again, I want to thank everybody for being here, and we'll adjourn this informational meeting. Thank you.